Hello and welcome to the Weekly Stuff Podcast with Jonathan Lack
and Sean Chapman.
We are here to talk about stuff this week on the show. We are talking about the big movie of the week, Deadpool 2.
The second Deadpool.
I liked it.
I liked it a lot too.
It's really funny.
It's a good movie. I think it's better than the first.
Way better than the first. Yep. Josh Brolin should be in everything. We'll get into that later.
I'm still trying to deal with the understanding that I'm living in a universe where there are two Deadpool movies and they're both like really good.
And they're both huge hits.
Yeah, they're both huge hits. And yeah, I never thought that this was the universe we lived in, Jonathan, but I guess it is.
I like that people are talking about superhero fatigue because Deadpool 2 did marginally less well than Deadpool 1 its opening weekend.
I saw that. It is like, have you not looked at Avengers Infinity War? It's the most fucking absurd thing to say.
Also, it's Deadpool 2. Yeah. None of us thought that movie would exist 5 years ago. Yeah. Anyway, we'll talk about that. We're going to talk about some news. We've got some video game stuff, some rumors. The E3 rumor mill is in full swing.
Yes, so we've it's the leakiest E3 I think I can think of.
Very, very leaky E3. Yeah. They need to go shut off the spigot somewhere. But we've got all of that. A little bit of housekeeping for you guys later this week. So this is a Tuesday podcast because we're recording this on Monday. So on this Thursday, we are going to have our next and for now final Doctor Who bonus podcast where we talk about the 8th Doctor, Paul McGann, and the audio story, The Chimes of Midnight. We just finished recording that, and it was a lot of fun.
Yes, it's a good story. I think it's a good podcast.
We do a little bit of wrap-up on our Doctor Who project. It's great. So you should listen to that when it comes out Thursday. We have also been looking at our plans for the coming weeks, and we know how we're going to cover E3. We are not doing 1 7-hour podcast.
No.
We're going to be doing daily podcasts for E3 this year. We've confirmed the dates. We know it's going to work. Barring some horrible accident, that's what we're going to do. So, new experiment for the Weekly Stuff podcast. Look forward to that second week of June when those are coming.
Yes, and be ready for me to be dead by the end of it.
Yes, because Sean is the note taker for E3.
Yes, that is my assigned task.
Yes.
I have trained for years. It is what I've honed my skills in, and I am ready to take irreverent notes about a terrible press conference again.
It's at the top of his resume.
Yes.
When you apply for a job, first thing, I take really good E3 notes.
I take really good E3 notes, and I can make some funny weed jokes also as I do it. It's basically my two skills.
All right. So you'll get all of that in the coming weeks. But first, Sean, let's do some stuff. What have you been up to?
I've been up to a couple of things. First thing I want to start with, I think this will be the last time I talk about obscure Norse poetry on this podcast, unfortunately. I've pitched to you, Jonathan, that we rebrand it as we talk about Digimon, we talk about Persona, we talk about Doctor Who, and we talk about Old Norse poetry, and you kind of vetoed the idea, which I think is fair because there's actually not that much to talk about.
There's only so many niches we can have, you know? It's like the Infinity Gauntlet. You can't fit more gems in there than there are places for.
Yeah. It's like when I vetoed your idea to make one of our other recurring segments on the podcast where we talk about movies where people fucking eat each other. It's just like, that was the thing that you wanted to do. I said, no, we can't do that.
The deep cut. That didn't come out of nowhere.
It's been brewing. Yeah. But to recap, after playing God of War, I wanted to say, you know, I have a degree in English literature. I should probably actually read some books on Norse mythology instead of just sort of watching Marvel movies and reading Wikipedia pages and playing God of War every once in a while. And so it's like, okay, I'm actually going to read this stuff. And so I read Neil Gaiman's Norse mythology, talked about that last week on the podcast. 2 thumbs up, great book. It's a great primer if you just want to sort of like get a very readable modern version of it. The other book I got was J.R.R. Tolkien's The Legend of Sigurd and Guttorm, which was written while he was alive, obviously, but was published posthumously by Christopher Tolkien, his son. And it is a modern, I don't even know how to describe it. It's like a modern retelling of the Saga of the Volsungs, which is a like ancient Norse saga that the poetic original version of it only exists in fragments. And the prose version of it, apparently J.R.R. Tolkien thought, was unacceptable and not good enough. So he decided, fuck it, I'm going to rewrite the Volsung Saga in poetry. And I'm going to do it in the same basic poetic style it would have originally been done in Old Norse.
God, if J.R.R. Tolkien had been a 13-year-old girl in the year 2005, he would have written the best live journal fan fiction.
Yeah, we would be living in a different world. It would be like fan fiction would be like the dominant form of literary fiction, like bar none. And it's like normal publishing houses would have been dissolved because they couldn't compete with the sheer quality and incredibleness of of fan fiction on the internet.
Characters you never imagined fucking would be fucking.
And they would be fucking in languages that you didn't even know existed. It would be amazing. But anyways, on last week's podcast, I had only read the 50-page long introduction to the book. I have not quite finished the full thing because I had other stuff to do, and there it is pretty dense when you get outside of the actual poetry. But I wanted to just read a section of the poetry of like the actual poem on this podcast because it's so fucking cool and it's so good, and it's the only way I would ever be able to sell anybody on reading this book because it's so obscure and weird.
Y'all came for a Deadpool 2 podcast. You're getting poetry reading? This is kind of the most Deadpool thing we could do.
It is. It is one. I'm breaking the podcast fourth wall by digging into something that nobody wants to listen to. And just to sort of set this up, because the reason why I find it so interesting is both I think it's really well written, but also the poetic style of it is not anything I've ever encountered before. And so it's written in what is alliterative verse. So basically, instead of it being so focused on the sort of stress-unstress thing and like iambic pentameter and rhyming schemes, which is something people might be familiar with of English poetry from like high school English, it's not rhyming poetry. It's much more about hitting like alliterative consonants in the right places with the right emphasis. And it's really interesting, and I think J.R.R. Tolkien is very, very good at it. So I'm going to read a section from the beginning, the Upphaf of The Legend of Sigurd and Gudrun, because J.R.R. Tolkien is such a nerd that when Christopher Tolkien discovered like the version of this poem that existed in the notes, all the different sections were, their titles were written in ancient Norse. And so Christopher Tolkien very kindly decided to put the translation of the ancient Norse title of the section in parentheses under in modern English.
That's nice of him.
Yeah, so Upphaf means beginning, I guess, apparently. So anyways, I'm going to read a couple of stanzas from this. A seer long silent, her song upraised, the halls hearkened, on high she stood. Of doom and death dark words she spake, of the last battle of the leaguered gods. The horn of Heimdall I hear ringing, the blazing bridge bends neath horsemen, the ashes groaning, his arms trembling, the wolf waking, warriors riding. The sword of Surt smoketh redly, the slumbering serpent in the sea moveth, a shadowy ship from shores of hell, legions bringeth to the last battle. The wolf Fenrir waits for Odin, for Frey the fair, the flames of Surt, the deep dragon shall be doom of Thor, shall all be ended, shall earth perish? If in day of doom one deathless stands, who death hath tasted and dies no more, the serpent slayer, seed of Odin, then all shall not end, nor earth perish. On his head shall be helm, in his hand lightning, a fire his spirit, in his face splendor. The serpent shall shiver, and surf waver, the wolf be vanquished, and the world rescued.
That's really good.
It's really fucking good. So if you like the poetry in Lord of the Rings, or if you like The Hobbit in Lord of the Rings at all, I knew that J.R.R. Tolkien was heavily inspired by stuff from Norse mythology. He just straight up stole shit. Because half the, like, basically the names of the dwarves from The Hobbit are all just from Norse mythology. So like they talk about Owain in here and shit. That's like, I didn't realize just how much of like The Hobbit is here. And like in this story of Sigurd, or you might also be familiar, it's the same story of like Siegfried that like some of the Wagner operas and stuff are based on. It's because it's like the Germanic myth is basically the same. The story of Sigurd, he like slays a dragon, he has a magic sword, and it's like there's stuff with like a cursed ring. There's a lot of like really clear parallels of like specific things that happen. It's like, oh fuck.
I gotta get this book now, Sean.
It's so good.
And it's not cheap.
Yeah, no, it's not cheap. It's a good book. It's basically impossible to read it without reading it out loud.
No, poetry's like that.
Yeah, but like specifically this alliterative verse, like you have to just read it aloud. Like it's impossible to even like for me absorb the information without reading it out loud. So nice. I think it's really cool. I was interested in the book obviously when I got it, but I didn't realize it was going to be that fucking awesome.
I was looking it up because some of his recent like posthumous works that Christopher Tolkien has done got some cool audiobook versions. Like Christopher Lee, while he was alive, did The Children of Húrin.
Oh, that's cool.
Which is awesome.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, did they get someone cool to do the audiobook? Not yet. There is no audiobook of it yet. Maybe one day. If Christopher Lee were alive, that would be perfect.
But yeah.
We got Ian McKellen.
You have Ian McKellen, yes.
He could read some Norse mythology to us.
There are a lot of fine British actors.
Or if you want to go weirdly meta, get Chris Hemsworth and just have him read it as Thor, and he keeps getting tripped up by the big words.
Yes, but whenever it's like a three-syllable word, he kind of has to like work his mouth around it a bit.
It's a 75-hour audiobook.
Yeah.
No. That's cool, Sean.
It's a great book. If you're interested in that kind of stuff, I recommend picking it up. It's very cool.
I look forward to next week's main topic. Instead of talking about the new Han Solo movie, you are just going to read that entire thing live on air.
Well, like, you should be grateful that, like, because I'm not going to go into this, but I also bought the prose Edda by Snorri Sturluson, the poetic Edda by the anonymous poet that obviously we don't know their name, the prose version of the Volsung Saga, and Ovid's Metamorphoses, which is, that's obviously not Norse mythology, but I was like, I'm giving it a mythology kick. I honestly should have read Ovid's Metamorphoses like years ago. That's like the more or less definitive text on Greek mythology, oddly enough written by a Roman, but that's the history we don't need to go into. But yeah, so I'm that's my like summer reading project. I'm going to spare you my like insights and critical takes.
I'm
on,
fine with it.
Maybe, on the prose Edda.
Maybe we do it at the end of the episode, not the beginning. But I'm good with it.
No, this is this fucking show stealer.
Okay, it's good. I haven't been this interested in your literary journeys since you did the Dynasty Warriors books,
Romance of the Three Kingdoms.
Yeah, like, I know them as the Dynasty Warriors books.
I mean, I think that's what Lo Gozhang was originally going for when he wrote it in the 14th century.
Some very dead Chinese guy is rolling in his grave as I say that.
The Dynasty Warriors books.
Yeah. They should do them like that. I wonder if there's like an edition in China.
Where there's like when the movie comes out.
The movie tie-in.
Oh my God.
Like sometimes Philip K. Dick's Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep is just sold as Blade Runner.
Uh-huh.
It's like so Dynasty Warriors, the book, and inside is Romance of the Three Kingdoms, and it's like illustrated with like images from the games.
Yeah, it's just like screenshots of the games. It's like they just take the fucking box art from the most recent Dynasty Warriors and just put it on the front as the cover. And someone picks it up as like, I can't believe the novelization of Dynasty Warriors is 2,000 pages long.
Hey, I'm just saying, let's be honest, you're probably going to sell more copies doing that than as Romance of the Three Kingdoms.
No, let's be honest, I don't think that's true, actually.
Okay, probably not, but anyway. More people would pick it off the shelf confused.
What they should do is, that should be whenever they make another Dynasty Warriors game next year. That should be like the, like, $200 collector's edition comes with like this really nice version of the Romance of the Three Kingdoms, but with a bunch of Dynasty Warriors shit on it.
Nice.
That'd be good.
You got any other stuff?
Nah, I think this is good.
All right.
Enough of my like obscure interests to burden this podcast with.
I've got an obscure interest thing I've been playing, but it relates to a lot of topics on this podcast. This week, I'd finished a lot of games. I finished Donkey Kong Country Tropical Freeze, I should say. I 100%ed it, which means I finished all the levels with all the Kong letters, got all the bonus levels, and beat the bonus world. And I now have hard mode to play, which if I beat, gets me 200% completion, because they do the weird percentages in these games. But great game, masterpiece, maybe my second or third favorite game on the Switch behind Breath of the Wild, and I don't know where it ranks relative to Mario Odyssey, but it's on par with that.
Okay.
Phenomenal game, y'all should play it if you have a Switch. Or if you have a Wii U, it's cheaper there. So there you go. But great game. And I'm waiting for Dark Souls to come out, and I just had an itch to play something new, and I tried playing some old stuff, but I just wasn't feeling it. And then, out of nowhere, I forgot this was coming out, but Atlus is still on their 3DS kick, where no company loves the Nintendo 3DS more than Atlus, if you just look at how many games they've put out for that thing. And, you know, like, Atlus had, or 3DS for a while has been the default Shin Megami Tensei platform. That's where 4 came out. That's where a lot of the spin-offs have come out. 5 is coming out of the Nintendo Switch, so clearly Shin Megami Tensei is more or less a Nintendo franchise these days. And this week, Atlus put out the enhanced remake of Shin Megami Tensei Strange Journey, which is a game from 2009. So, like, immediate, if you're placing it's like post Persona 3 and 4.
Yeah.
In the larger Shin Megami Tensei world. It was originally a Nintendo DS game. They've redone it for 3DS as Shin Megami Tensei Strange Journey Redux. And, of course, they've added a new character and a new dungeon, and now it's voice acted. It wasn't before, only in Japanese. They did not dub it for here, but you can read it in English. It'd be weird if they just put it out with kanji. That'd be a little hard for a lot of people, myself included.
Yeah.
But yes, so it's out here now. Again, 3DS remake. And I've heard about this game because it is revered in like the Shin Megami Tensei circles. And I have also always wanted to play a Shin Megami Tensei game because I love the Persona games so much. I love Persona Q so much, which is an Etrian Odyssey spinoff. So I know of these other like more hardcore, quote-unquote, Atlus franchises through Persona, which is kind of the more... This is weird to say about 100-hour JRPGs, but is the more casual arm of Atlus.
Yes.
you know, weirdly.
Sounds weird, but it is very true.
Yes, very true. But I've always wanted to play a mainline Shin Megami Tensei game, because, again, 5 is going to be coming out for the Switch, and I'm definitely going to want to cover that, but I want a little bit of experience with this under my belt. And when Strange Journey Redux came out, I started reading some reviews of it, and the premise of this game I found so irresistible, I had to go pick it up. And I'll tell you how I picked it up in a second, because I got it on the cheap for reasons you'll find out in a second. But here's the premise.
He murdered a man and stole it from him.
I'll just say it now.
Okay.
Sean, I told you I was going to play Far Cry 5.
You abandoned that?
Oh, God.
I wanted you to play that game so bad, though.
So I got Far Cry 5 with my PS4 Pro, which I bought. So I got it for free. I put it in. I played an hour of that game. Sean, the game is fucking terrible. I hate everything about that game. I'm not even into having played a lot of good open world games recently, yeah. I immediately saw the just fucking barrage of objectives on my... I'm like, nope. I played like an hour, hour and a half. I like knocked down a couple of temples. I did one. I'm like, no. And I pulled it out, and I've been waiting for a time when I could trade it in and get some money. And I did, and I put it towards a Shin Megami Tensei game. And I will tell you, the person who was manning the counter was very confused at that request of Far Cry 5 on PS4 for Shin Megami Tensei Strange Journey Redux on 3DS. He did not know what it was or if they had it in stock.
Fair enough.
Yes.
That it doesn't sound like a real video game title.
No, it does not.
To be totally honest.
But here's the premise of Strange Journey. So, I should say, this game was actually, when it was being developed, it was kind of planned as Shin Megami Tensei 4. It's not just like a spin-off.
Right.
And eventually they decided it's so different in setting than the other ones, which are all set in Tokyo, that they would do a different game as 4, which became Shin Megami Tensei 4 for the Nintendo 3DS. But so this one is a full Shin Megami Tensei game. But what it is it's set... nondescript future. It's the year 20XX, as it always is in these games. And a mysterious phenomenon has appeared at the South Pole in Antarctica called the Schwarzwelt. And it is like this weird black hole dimension that is slowly growing and enveloping the Earth. It's basically the plot of the movie Annihilation.
Okay.
But pitched more like it's a John Carpenter movie, or maybe a Michael Crichton book, if you've ever read any of his like original like sci-fi books, where it's like that hard science where the characters are all like really good at their jobs.
Yeah.
And you know, Michael Crichton's politics got weird near the end of his life, but I always loved reading those books as a kid. It's got kind of all of that in it, but basically you are part of a United Nations task force. So the cast is all like multinational from around the world, and you are a member of the strike team, the main character. And these four ships basically go down to the Schwarzwelt. Their plan is to try to infiltrate it, get into its boundaries, figure out what is in there so it can be destroyed. Again, very much like the plot of Annihilation or something. And you get in there, and it is very strange. Basically, it is a portal to other dimensional planes where weird stuff is happening. The first dungeon I'm in right now is like, it looks like Antarctica. It's ice and it's caves and stuff. But then you start to learn about these other places, and you see glimpses from like the sensors of like a shopping mall and weird consumerist stuff that's going on. So I'm very excited. It is like I'm probably 3 or 4 hours into it, so not much. Tip of the iceberg for a JRPG, right?
Ha!
But
tip of the iceberg.
That's very true.
Antarctica.
But like as JRPG openings go, it really is like such an enticing premise because it feels like this game could go anywhere. I think it is like paced and written kind of perfectly to keep you kind of on the edge of your seat of like, you really don't know where you're going. I really like that in this kind of game. Because usually like a big JRPG is you're out in a cool fantasy setting or you're in Tokyo or something.
Yeah.
And the, you know, maybe you'll get to some mysterious stuff like Tartarus in Persona 3 is kind of an analog. But you have more grounding. This is, you are out in the middle of nowhere. You have entered this other thing. You are untethered from humanity. You're trying to get back or go forward. You're not really sure. And it's just so unclear where you're going. It also like adds this kind of urgency to all the like dungeon crawling stuff you do, which is the main part of this game. It's a dungeon crawler. It's kind of like Etrian Odyssey without the mapping. It auto maps for you, but it's a first person JRPG.
Yeah.
You move through that way. You've got to, you know, your bottom screen is your map, and you've got to keep a pretty clear eye on it. And then there are random encounters. And then it's got all the other Shin Megami Tensei stuff where you've got your demons, you negotiate with them, they join your party, you can fuse your demons. And there's all that stuff, which is great. That's always one of the best parts of these games. You know, I miss having, like, Igor there to help me fuse my demons. It's a little, you know, I just go into my menu to fuse my demons, which is very, you know, it's convenient. It's not as cool as going to the Velvet Room and having a cool dude with a nose.
Nothing ever will be.
No, nothing ever will be. But that's okay. And overall, I'm just really liking this game. Like, the characters are not, you know, as, you know, pop off the screen as, like, Persona characters or something. But I also think the kind of fiction this is, that's not what they're supposed to be. And also, this is the other, this is the thing that pushed me over the edge. This has a Shoji Meguro score. This is one of those times when he went and did a Shin Megami Tensei. Oh, it's good. It's really good. When I talk about it kind of keeping you on the edge of your seat, part of it is Meguro just tightens the screws musically, and he's so good at that, and it's all so amazing. There's one track that plays early on when the first kind of emotional beat of the game happens that sounds like it's right out of Persona 3 or 4, but different, and oh, I'm loving it. This is a cool game. You know, I'm probably going to play it kind of in fits and starts because other things are going on, but it's on the 3DS, which is nice. Because I can always just kind of go play a little bit of it whenever I want. They've added a lot of little quality of life features that, as I understand it, were not there in the original. You can save much more easily. You can heal more easily. Like, it's not as... Like, as I understand it, the original was very much a hardcore Megami Tensei grind fest. Mm-hmm. This has a lot of things to ameliorate that. The main difficulty is not where it was in the original game, all of those things. But it's cool. Like, I feel like if Shin Megami Tensei is a franchise that has scared you in the past, which it kind of has me, frankly, it's a daunting franchise.
Yeah,
this feels about as accessible an entry as I can think of, in part because of, you know, like, the Tokyo stuff is cool in the other games, but some of that also, like, there's a lot of exploration around it, I know, that can be daunting if you don't actually know Tokyo, because you're not Japanese.
Yeah.
But this one being, like, that Schwarzwald thing is such an immediate hook. It feels like so many other pieces of kind of international fiction you might like. It's a very cool game.
Awesome.
I'm enjoying it.
Yeah.
It's also got the fucking best cover art. That was part of it, too, was I just wanted to, like, have the box and, like, put it on my shelf. And be like, that looks cool. You should look this up.
Yes, I'm looking it up because since we recorded also, this is behind-the-scenes stuff, recorded the Doctor Who podcast earlier. I have my laptop with me.
So it's a two-laptop podcast.
It is. Yes, that is a good, that's very good box art.
Yes. So yes. I'm excited to play more of this. It just seems cool.
Awesome. So, yeah. Well, I look forward to hearing more about this strange journey you've been on.
All right, let's move on to the news.
What's going on in the news, Jonathan?
Again, a lot of horrible stuff, but in the stupid news...
Yes, the stupid news.
Let's do some video game news, Sean. I've got all video game news this week. No movie stuff going on that I wanted to talk about, so there you go.
Okay.
The movie stuff is just there's a shit ton of movies coming out, so, you know, we'll get to those when we get to those.
Yeah.
First off, Sony has announced, discreetly, but Kotaku scooped this and then confirmed it, that they are ending physical game cartridge production for the PlayStation Vita. They are not completely cutting off the PlayStation Vita. Like, the online store is still there. People can still publish and sell, and then we can buy games. But they will no longer be making cartridges. That also means that third parties cannot manufacture their games physically. So the physical marketplace for the PlayStation Vita is effectively shutting down. This is happening fairly soon. I looked this up. Are they producing the PlayStation Vita itself at all anymore, or has that been done for a while now?
Because
it's
not
hard.
Sure.
I've looked it up, and it's hard to find new ones. But I don't know if that means they're done or not. Either way, obviously, this is another nail in the coffin of the PlayStation Vita. You know, it had, I think, probably a better life than you would have thought, given all the ways Sony really tried to fuck this system up.
Yeah.
You know, and I think especially now with the Nintendo Switch on the market. Like, the Switch is what the Vita always wanted to be and never quite was. So, you know, I guess it's just, I don't necessarily think this is, like, momentous news or anything, but just as two people who were fans of the PlayStation Vita, it is interesting. It does effectively signal that the party's over, like, we're shutting this. Like, again, I don't think they're going to cut off the eShop or whatever they call it anytime soon, but, like, I think the Vita's experience is mostly over.
Yeah, and it's like, it feels appropriate, you know. It's the Persona dancing games are coming out on the Vita, at least in Japan, which they're coming out on Thursday, May 24th, as I can see on my pre-order on Amazon.co.jp right now.
Yes.
For 13,799 yen.
You didn't have to tell the people that.
It's so much. It's too much. I don't know why I'm doing it, but it's there, and it's so close.
Are you getting them for Vita or PS4?
No, PS4.
Oh, that's what I thought. Okay.
I'm not a fucking maniac.
Well, that also means that...
What do you think I am?
Do you think those are going to be ported to the Vita at all over here? If they come
I have no idea. I suspect the digital version would be, because I can't imagine that... Like, if you're doing all the work to localize it, it seems like it would just be more cost-effective to bring the Vita version over also.
I thought that about Dragon Quest XI.
That's true.
But Square Enix was like, fuck you guys, that's on a viable system that sells a lot, but whatever.
Yeah, but the Vita's,
I'm sorry, Atlas is smarter.
Yeah, but the Vita's fucking sexy, and the 3DS is this big clamshell-like clunky thing with pixely graphics.
Like, the 3DS is some of the best games ever made on it.
Yeah, but it's not sexy is what I'm saying. You can have a lot of good games. Like, the N64 had a lot of good games. That's the least fucking sexy console on the planet.
Very good point. Good point. But yes. Yeah. So any other thoughts on the slow marching death of the PlayStation Vita?
I like the PlayStation Vita a lot.
It's a good little system.
Yeah.
You can play Persona games on it. You can play almost every Final Fantasy on it.
Yeah, like it's such a good machine for like the Sony back catalog, which is something that sadly you cannot say about the PS4.
God.
So like if you want to play PS1 games and PSP games, that's what the PS Vita is.
Can I just rant about that for a second?
Sure.
Because it is. The Vita is great. You can play all your PS1 games, all your PSP games. That's great. Or your PS1 digital ones. But that's a lot of them. That was so cool about the Vita. I am still annoyed that the PS4 has zero backwards compatibility solution. PlayStation Now doesn't fucking count. And, like, we don't call them on that enough. Like, this weekend, I for an upcoming project we might be doing, I wanted to load one of my Mass Effect save files and run around in that for a minute. And so I had to lug out my PS3 and plug that in and put it in all that.
Yeah.
And it's because that's where I played the Mass Effect games in full. I have them on backwards compat on the 360, or the Xbox One. But I didn't want to get that out because it's got like a 40-foot power brick. So anyway, I plug in my PS3 and I just realized I have so much good stuff on my PS3. I have just so much cool stuff. And not a one of them has been pulled over in any form other than sometimes they might re-release the game, like Grand Theft Auto 5 or something. But it's like, it's fucking stupid and it annoys me.
Yeah, it's
there's no good excuse.
I mean, well, the thing is, like, the PS3 and PS4 have such different architectures. Like, that cell processor is a fucking bitch.
Sure.
From what I understand.
But if the PS Vita can play PS1 games, they could get those over.
Yes, no. PS1 and PS2, there's no good excuse. Like, they should have found, like, a good... I'm not necessarily expecting, like, to be able to put my fucking PS1, like, compact discs in there, you know, and get it to work. But there should be, like, a big virtual console-esque solution on the PS4, and there's not.
Yeah, like, you know, we talked about this with the Switch last week, and they're at least doing something with that that's you know, because again, the thing with PlayStation Now, why I say it doesn't count, is it's just literally a lot of people can't play it. Like, I have never lived somewhere with a good enough internet connection where that would be reliable, you know? So anyway, we've gotten really off track. Here's something cool. Xbox One, they have no games anymore. It's a fucking dead zone for video games.
You know, E3's coming around is one thing.
They might announce...
They have this chance.
They do. We might hear about the Gears of War 5 game once.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Or Forza Horizon 5.
I am excited for that. And it'll be 4.
Yes.
But anyway. But here's something. We shit on Xbox a lot. Here's something unambiguously awesome that the Xbox team has done. They announced this week formally the Xbox Adaptive Controller. Which will be sold later this year for $100. And it is a controller for people with various disabilities that allow them to play Xbox One games more easily. There are lots of solutions out there for people without full motor function or other, you know, handicaps that prevent them from playing video games. There are lots of solutions, but what this is trying to do is create like a unified system. It's like this, you know, kind of slab with two big sort of button paddle things, and then the other main buttons, and then a bunch of inputs where you can plug in kind of all these different things, and it's fully customizable, and you can basically create any play solution you want. And there's really never been anything like this in the main first-party console space in the history of gaming. There have been third-party solutions, but there are obviously many, many... you know, if you had to, with full mobility, had to use a Mad Catz controller as a kid or something, imagine if you didn't and you were trying to find a better solution. Yeah. That would be infuriating. This is really cool. Xbox, throughout this generation, has had a... absolutely admirable commitment to adaptability. They were the first to input complete button mapping on the Xbox One, which obviously helps people with disabilities. PlayStation 4 then adopted that. So they've really been kind of the leader in the market on this sort of thing. You know, as they've had their gaming difficulties this generation, I do think the Xbox One will be remembered for quite a few important, like, quality of life innovations.
Yeah.
I think this is maybe the biggest one, but some of the stuff they've done with backwards compatibility and content management has been very cool too. But either way, this is a cool thing. You know, this is not the kind of thing you make because you want to go make $1 billion. This is not the kind of thing you make to, like, you know, make your system super popular. It's something you do because you think it's something, you know, people need and would be a good thing to have on the market for the community. And I think that's cool and admirable. And they put out a, like, 3-minute video about it. And I would highly recommend you go watch that, because it's not just, like, an empty marketing video. They actually show, like, doctors talking about it and people who would need this using it and showing how it works. That's just a very neat thing.
Yeah, it's just, it's the kind of thing that should be standard in the industry. Like every, like, Sony should make one of these, Nintendo should make one of these. Like, it's the kind of thing that, it's been a long time coming of those issues being something that the industry takes more seriously. It's like in the past 5 or so years, I feel like it's becoming more of a thing of games having, like, colorblind modes and games being more serious about, they still have a long way to go with subtitles for whatever reason, but they're getting better. And it's like, there's a lot of stuff like that games are getting a lot better at, sort of realizing, oh, we have a broad, diverse range of people that play our games that have specific needs that we can accommodate in different ways if you just think about it and take it into consideration. And there are lots of solutions to all this kinds of stuff. And yeah, having an accessibility controller is a huge step that is much more thorough than the very kind of ad hoc, you know, make it so that, like, the D-pad does the face buttons or whatever, like, that you can do of the button changing on both the Xbox One and the PS4. Like, that's a good feature and was a good step to be able to do with software. This is a much better, like, full comprehensive movement. And so I think, like, everybody should do it when the new consoles come around. Like, these controllers should go forward or have new ones come out. Like, it should just be standard.
Absolutely. Because video games are, one of the many ways they're a unique medium is that technological factor where, you know, there are more limitations to playing a video game than watching a movie or reading a book or something.
Yeah.
And the ways we accommodate, you know, disability in, you know, like books, if you're blind, you use Braille, or on, you know, movies, there are subtitles for the deaf, or there is assisted hearing for people who have vision loss, things like this. There isn't kind of a unified, agreed upon solution for video games yet. This is a really great step forward towards it, and it's good to just have some, you know, big party out there kind of driving the market on this, because, you know, it's a more complex problem to solve with video games, but it is completely solvable, and yeah, it's something people should be putting the effort into.
Absolutely.
So that's cool. More people should be able to play video games.
Not yes, one. Absolutely.
All right. Speaking of video games, actually, I'm going to save the E3 stuff for the end. Let's do this really quick. So Best Buy announced this week, not formally, but to employees, that note leaked. We also know because they've taken this off the website. But Best Buy, big retailer here in the States, has announced that they are ending their Gamers Club Unlocked program, GCU. I have this program. I love it. It's a $30 per 2 years program that gives you 20% off all physical video games. They kind of say it's new ones, but they'll give it to you for fucking anything, mm-hmm, which is amazing. Also, like, Amiibos and collector's editions, kind of anything video game related that's not a console or a controller, they will give you 20% off on. Huge savings. They also give you extra for trade-ins. They give you, you know, rewards the more you buy, all these things. So, like, if you buy video games regularly, it's the best deal in video gaming. Best Buy started this years ago, and Amazon, if you have Amazon Prime, they do this for some new video games during the pre-order period. It used to be broader. They've limited it a lot. Amazon was trying to compete with Best Buy because of this. And I remember I bought this last year with Best Buy, and I thought to myself, this is probably too good for Best Buy to keep around.
Yeah.
And apparently it is. They are not selling this anymore. You know, there's the possibility that they are going to be reintroducing and revamping this as a different program with a different set of benefits, but we're not sure. You cannot join this program anymore if you haven't already. If you did, benefits will last until they run out for current customers. That's the current plan. Good for me. I have it until August of 2019.
There you go.
So I have a lot of cheaper games to get. But I thought this was significant because it's kind of discouraging to me. Because Best Buy started this whole 20% off physical games thing. Great program. The only competitor is Amazon Prime, which has cut way back on those benefits despite hiking the price of Amazon Prime.
Yeah.
And I also think it's a further nail in the coffin for physical video games. And whatever your thought is on the debate of, like, do I prefer, you know, my games on the disc, on the cart, or do I want to get them digital? There's pros and cons to each, obviously. To me, one of the things it comes down to is that when you have physical video games on the market, there is competition, and you are not driven towards one price point the way you are with digital goods.
Yeah.
Digital goods, they don't have to be this way. But of course, it's the way dirty capitalists make it, is that digital goods are always more expensive. There is no fucking sense in the world to that, because it's way cheaper to make a digital good.
Yeah.
There is no physical production cost. There are no delivery costs, other than like having a server or something like that. But they are generally more expensive, and they are also inflexible. There's no price competition. You know, if you want to buy God of War digitally on the PlayStation Store is the only place to access it. You could buy a code on Amazon or GameStop or something, but those prices are never going to fluctuate because they have to take 100% of the hit, because what they're selling you is a code to use on that other person's store. So there is no competition. When you have competition, you have things like this where, I mean, this is just basic, you know, business theory, right? But you will have a Best Buy and an Amazon fighting like this to get the prices down. It means as games age, that if you want to wait 6 months to buy a game, if it's you go get the physical version, it is almost invariably going to be cheaper. Like I bought, you did the same thing, Assassin's Creed Origins last year, like 2 months after it came out on Black Friday, and it was way cheaper, you know? Yes. And that just happens. And that does not generally happen with digital games. There will be sales every once in a while. You know, there's Steam did their whole Steam sales. I guess they probably still do that, but no one cares.
Yeah.
And PlayStation and Xbox do, you know, decent sales every now and then, but they're not incentivized to, like, sell their best games at that, like, lowest price points, right?
Yeah.
And especially once physical games go away, they're going to have very little incentive to compete here. So, you know, physical media is good for a lot of reasons. You know, I talk about this on the movie side of thing. You don't get good movie restorations or bonus features or any kind of decent film preservation for digital media, because there's no real profit in that. Like, physical media is where you, if you like a movie and you like that it looks nice now, that's because someone bought a DVD. Like, period. That's, it would not happen if they only had digital distribution. So, like, you know, if you want to mourn the death of physical media in these ways, and I don't think physical media is anywhere near dead in a lot of ways, that's one of the things that makes me kind of sad, and I just wanted to talk about it here because it is something I've been thinking about, that while the price of video games has not risen in quite a while since the beginning of the previous gaming generation to $60, the effective price we're paying in some ways has, just in terms of, like, there are fewer and fewer ways to kind of get around that price point.
Yeah, and then, it's, you know, that's where microtransactions come in. That is where, like, a billion special editions, like video game companies have gotten very creative with how they try to get money out of you.
Yes. But it's nice when you had a program like this that at least, like, if you were a frequent buyer of video games, this was just kind of unambiguously a good deal for you. That's probably why it couldn't stick around, because the house always wins. But
and Best Buy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're probably dying anyway.
Yes. Yeah.
But yeah, oh well. I bet that Amazon benefit. That Amazon thing, they really sold that hard at the beginning, and they've cut back and back and back and back on that. And it's kind of funny. That'll probably disappear any day now. But, oh well.
Pouring out for Toys R Us.
So, yeah.
They're gone. It's over.
I mean, the biggest surprise of that announcement was that Toys R Us was still a thing. So,
yeah.
Anyway. All right. Wanted to say that. And now let's finish with some E3 preview stuff. Because this,
Jonathan, this isn't our E3 preview podcast. Why are we talking about E3 preview stuff now?
Because E3 is super fucking leaky this year.
Yes, it is.
All right. So
there damn have been, you, Canadian Walmarts.
Indeed. There have been E3 leaks that have been clearly bullshit. We're not talking about those. There have been some E3 leaks that seem true. We're going to talk about a couple of those. And there have been some that were obviously true, and then the people just came out and confirmed them. We'll talk about one of those. But we're just going to hit some of the big ones here. First off, what you're referring to is the thing that kicked all of this off, kind of, was a Canadian Walmart leaked a store page, probably planned for the week of E3, that revealed titles such as Rage 2, Gears of War 5, Borderlands 3, Splinter Cell, Just Cause 4, a new Assassin's Creed, and a bunch more. Nothing hugely surprising there, although clearly a couple that were going to be big reveals.
I actually kind of want to, because I have the actual image, I just kind of want to go down this game by game, because I think that's easy to just sort of, like, say a sentence about each of these, because this is something that actually happened a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
I'm glad we didn't talk about it immediately, because the story kind of developed, because when this first hit, I was sort of suspicious of it, because it seemed too convenient. I was just like, so many of these are too easy, except for the one that we'll talk about. So, Tom Clancy's The Division 2 was already confirmed, but that was up there. Splinter Cell. Yes, please. Make another Splinter Cell game. Hopefully that's real. Hopefully that's actually going to... I mean, Ubisoft...
When was the last one?
Blacklist, which was 2013, I think. It was right at the end of Xbox 360 and PS3. That game was really good and, like, horribly underrated. Like, nobody played it, basically, which is why we haven't had a Splinter Cell game since.
So we haven't had one this generation.
Nope. So Splinter Cell Insurgency Sandstorm, which is some sort of, like, I think it's like a free-to-play first-person shooter on the PC or something, which I guess has come to consoles. I don't know. There is, like, it's so unknown that I saw a lot of people reporting that, like, and this mysterious game called Insurgency, that's like, it must be some new big exclusive, and then it's just like, no, it's just a game that actually exists that nobody talks about. Like, it's not new at all. Last of Us 2, we knew about that. Just Cause 4, that one's kind of interesting because I felt like Just Cause 3 did not do that well, and Avalanche Studios is also working on Rage 2, which we'll get to. So that seems interesting that they're doing a split team there. WWE 2K19, they will make WWE games until we are all dead. Dragon Quest 2, this is my favorite one, maybe my favorite one of these. I don't... It must be Dragon Quest Builders 2, right?
It must be.
That has to be what that's referring to. But I love that. So for people who haven't seen the image, it is just like a store page with like mocked up boxes. But the boxes all are basically for like the unannounced games are black with just like a white font text in the middle that says the title. So it's just this like, it looks like it's the most like premier version of Dragon Quest 2. Like yeah. I kind of almost wanted to be just a re-release of the Famicom game.
Wouldn't that be fucking funny though if they are actually just straight up planning a like remake of randomly Dragon Quest 2?
Yeah, that would be the most amazing if like Square Enix just goes, like they have their fucking press conference they're doing this year for some reason that they didn't do like the last 2 years, I think. The last time they did a press conference was when they did Nier Automata and announced that game. It would just be so amazing if that was the opening, was just them going up. And it's also like, this is actually the box art. It's just this austere black with white text, Dragon Quest II. It's fucking, you know, it's like, here we are, peak video game.
It also could be Dragon Quest XI, because we know that's coming to the PS4, yeah. But
maybe
I don't
there's
know
someone
the...
who thought that 11 was 2 in Roman numerals. Maybe Weirdly,
they don't
know.
Possible.
Maybe they don't know how numbers work in Canada. I've never been, so I'm not sure.
Do they have numbers in Canada?
I mean, all these games cost fucking $80 apparently, so they, okay. Something wrong is going up there.
I love you, Canada. You're great.
You're a better country than America. Like, you have it hands down. Let us make these jokes. It makes us feel better about ourselves.
Yeah. We'll go pay for our expensive drugs.
Another game, Destiny Comet. This is presumably just like the next expansion to Destiny 2, because that's what they refer to. The expansions for Destiny 1 were called Comets. Final Fantasy VII Remake, which I have to assume is not going to be the title of that game, because that just is too...
No. Does that maybe indicate we're going to hear more about it this year? Because it's been absent for a while.
Yeah, there's got to be. That has to be at the Square Enix press conference. Like, there's no way they give a press conference and don't talk about that.
Well, because, maybe... It actually does make sense why Square Enix would have one this year, because they have Kingdom Hearts, which apparently is far along than maybe we thought.
I thought it was like seemed like it was coming out.
Yeah, but it's Kingdom Hearts 3.
Yeah.
I needed someone to actually sit down and play it before that.
Yeah.
But there's that. They've got the Final Fantasy. They got Dragon Quest. Like, they have enough this year. Dragon Quest Builders. So, yeah.
So, I'm expecting we'll see that there. Metroid Prime 4. Knew about that. NBA 2K19. Also, like WWE, they will make those games until we're all dead. Super Smash Bros., which they just have as Super Smash Bros. Borderlands 3. So, this is one of, like, the bigger things. We had basically known that Gearbox was going to make another Borderlands game, because why wouldn't they? But it's
been a while.
Yeah, it's been a long time, because Borderlands 2 was like 2011 or 2012. So kind of like Splinter Cell. It's around that same time frame. I'm curious to see what a Borderlands 3 was. I did not like Borderlands 1. I enjoyed the gameplay of Borderlands 2 and hated the story. But, you know, I'll probably check it out. I'd be curious to see what Borderlands 3 is like in a post-Destiny world, because I feel like Destiny kind of like took the Borderlands idea and kind of like updated it. Assassin's Creed. This is one of the interesting ones, because this just says Assassin's Creed. I don't know what that, like, if that's a new game, if that's an expansion, if that's whatever.
Because we've debated about this, whether we think there's going to be a new one this year.
It can't be a full new Assassin's Creed, right? Like, you played fucking Origins.
Yeah.
Like, I played about 2/3 of Origins and then fell off because I think something else came out. Like, that game is so huge. There's no fucking way they make a sequel to that game in 1 year.
Well... I mean, but if they're team cycling, someone else could have been doing this for a while.
Yeah, I think, but it's like, that game is such a big step Ford like changes so much about how that franchise works. It's just the idea of them making another one that would come out.
They did Unity after Black Flag, so I'm not going to put any of this past
that. That's true. But Black Flag wasn't even that different. Like, it added a new system onto the game, but it didn't change the systems that already existed for Assassin's Creed. So yeah. That's why, like, or like, if they made a new one, they would have to either make a new old Assassin's Creed game or make a new Assassin's Creed game in Assassin's Creed Origins model.
I'm also not
sure they do that.
Like, I do believe that something's coming out, but they already did the Rogue remaster earlier this year, so I don't. And they did the Ezio collection like 2 years ago.
Maybe it's just called Assassin's Creed. Maybe it's a redo of Assassin's Creed 1, and they make it a good video game now.
Maybe, Sean, maybe it's the game version of the movie. Maybe they got Michael Fassbender, they got Academy Award winner Marion Cotillard, and they're going to do the voices for a game where you don't go into the past and you just are in a bad, like, thriller movie.
I'm really upset that you mentioned that movie because it reminded me that we made a promise to watch that movie.
We did. That was like 5 months ago.
Yeah.
I have the DVD.
Is it still in your bag?
It's in my other bag.
Okay, it's in your other bag.
Which I haven't used for 3 months.
So there we go. Another game, Lego DC Villains. I believe that. They make everything will be a Lego game eventually. Beyond Good and Evil 2. I would be honestly surprised if Ubisoft talked about this game. Just because it's like, it felt like it was a not actual video game they talked about at the end of last
season. Right, it was one of their big reveals, but it was just a cinematic.
Yeah, it was just a cinematic, and then everything they talked about, it seemed like, it's the open shared world, and it's like, this is not a video game. Rage 2.
You want to just say this now? So Rage 2. Bethesda did just decide to formally announce this after the leak. It's not coming until next year, 2019. It's being developed by Avalanche Studios, which did not do Rage 1, but did Mad Max, the 2015 game.
Yeah.
And Sean, I have to be honest, I didn't know what Rage 1 was. Everyone was talking about Rage 2. I'm like, what is Rage? What kind of game? I literally knew nothing about this game.
That is fair enough. I have never played Rage. I know that Rage has its fans, but it was not particularly well received. And it just seemed like, because it came out near the end of, it's another kind of like talking about Splinter Cell, talking about Borderlands, another end of the last generation thing of like, it was trying to do something new. This is before like they, you know, have had their recent successes with the new Wolfenstein and Doom. And it's like, it always just seemed like, kind of like with Borderlands, it's just like shit take on Mad Max, which is just like bad. I never liked the look of it. I never liked the style. And it was just seemed like it was a first-person shooter that, from what I understand, had open-world elements. And there were some people that sort of... all I've heard about it that people like about it is, like, the shooting was really good, but the story and, like, the open-world stuff was all really bad. Apparently they're making a sequel to it.
It's so such a strange business move, though. It's kind of like what they did with Prey last year.
Yes,
it does. They dusted off an IP they had.
Gave it to a totally different studio that didn't work on the first game.
And just was like, hey, people like their IP. We don't have to buy a new website domain for this.
Yeah.
I don't get it. Like, why not just have Avalanche Studios make a new game? Because here's the thing. I host a video game podcast. Yes. I didn't know what Rage was. I assume a lot of people who play video games actively are in that same boat.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I would say the mainstream video game player has never heard of Rage and does not give a shit.
Which means I'm probably not going to play Rage 2. It's probably a completely separate thing, but I'm not going to play Rage 2. But if they announced, like, whatever it is, just cool new game, Fury, whatever they're going to call it.
Wrath,
you know, and it has no baggage behind it, then I'm like, oh, cool new IP, that's awesome. Bethesda generally does very good work.
Yeah.
They're a pretty responsible company with what they put out. But this is a weird business strategy. Prey was kind of the same weird. At least that wasn't called, like, Prey 2, though.
Exactly. They were just like, fuck it, we're just going to call it Prey.
It has zero to do with the last one. So I don't know. Very strange.
Yeah, Rage 2 was the one that, like, when I saw this list, when it originally leaked, was either like, this list is either true or bullshit entirely off the back of this, because this list was either made by some disgruntled Canadian Walmart employee that said, like, was quitting their job and decided to, like, just throw this up and just, like, fuck it. Like, we have access to all of this. And they're like, whatever, Rage 2... I don't even care, like, fuck Canadian Walmart, which that's how I assume this happened. Or it was some weird pervert that is a big fan of Rage, which just, like, was like, no, I'm gonna let the world know there's one motherfucker wants Rage 2. It's not real, it's bullshit, but I'm putting Rage 2 out there. Apparently that it was the Canadian Walmart disgruntled employee version of the story, not the weird pervert. I mean, he might.
Why has he got to be a pervert?
Because he likes Rage in my this hypothetical scenario enough to make up a league that Rage 2 is in. Which there's no way that you would even remember, even if you played and liked Rage, you'd even remember that Rage 1 existed enough to make a fake Rage 2 league unless you had a weird sexual obsession with it. That's my logic.
Okay.
Other game, Dreams. We have known about that since the announcement of the PS4, when that game was originally released. Or I talked about with Media Molecule. This is all like other console versions of the other stuff. This is my favorite one. This is the best one. Forza Horizon 5. I love that it's because we knew that they're making no Forza Horizon game, but the last one is 3.
Yes.
So there's. This was the other one that when this came out, it's like this is either what makes it true or bullshit. It's like either the people at Walmart are so incompetent, which I totally believe that they put in the wrong number for the next Forza Horizon game, and so the leak is legitimate, or it's some asshole who's trying to make it seem like that and faking the leak and being like, I'm going to say it's 5 instead of 4 to be weird.
Yeah.
I don't know. I just love that it says Forza Horizon 5, and I would be so.
They also call it Forza Horizons.
It's called Forza Horizons 5.
Yes. It's called Forza Horizon. There's no S on it. Yeah. Maybe there is in Canada. I don't know.
I would be tickled pink if on the Microsoft stage they announced Forza Horizons 5 and it's not Forza Horizon 4. That would be the best. That would be the best way the E3 could go.
They went from Windows 8 to Windows 10, so anything's possible.
It's totally possible. And then Gears of War 5. Fuck you! Don't make any more Gears of War games. What are you doing?
Also, that one's weird. Gears of War 4 was just last year. No, 2016, I should say.
Yeah, and so it's like, obviously, we can't assume that this is in any way comprehensive, because there's lots of games like Spider-Man that we know that they're going to talk about that are not on this, but it's interesting that there's no Halo, you'd assume, because it's like, Halo 6 has got to come out before Gears of War 5, right? That'd be crazy.
I don't know. I think the fact that we haven't heard a goddamn peep out of Halo 6 tells me Halo 6 is a ways off. Like, yeah. I think this year the Halo game is a Reach Anniversary Edition. That is my prediction. Well, spoiling, in a couple weeks we're going to do our E3 predictions. Yeah. That's one of them.
Yeah.
I don't think we're seeing. We might see it. I don't think Halo 6 is this year. But I can buy that they're like, we have nothing else. Let's rush Gears of War 5 out the door. And maybe they'll do the Call of Duty Black Ops 4 thing where they just don't even bother with a campaign this time. It's just all Horde all the time.
It's all Horde. It's Horde. It's competitive multiplayer. And they like try to make a Gears of War Battle Royale mode, which sounds like the most desperate, terrible thing on the planet.
It's gonna happen.
Yeah, this is stuff to go into more depth a couple weeks from now when we do our full predictions podcast.
Yes,
but it was a nice little present from Canada.
Yes, like, little moose boosh.
Rage 2 is happening, and I wonder what Bethesda's original strategy was going to be for announcing Rage 2, because I suspect this worked out in their favor, because if at like the end of their E3 showcase. They had been like, and we have one more game to show you. And everybody's saying, there's like, it's going to be Todd Howard's next game. It's going to be like Elder Scrolls 6. Oh my God, it's finally happening. And this like Rage 2 is up on stage. The just sheer confusion and disappointment from that crowd would have been so palpable. Like the earth would, like the earth's gravitational pull would have like tightened from like just how like bummed everyone would be at that fucking show. Now everyone knows that Rage 2 exists. We have to accept that it's a fact. And well before that E3 showcase, so when they show their trailer, we can just be bored and not pay attention.
Sounds good to me. Let's do two Nintendo rumors, too.
Okay.
And not one of these, I think, is very much true. One of them might be a rumor, might be real. I'm leaning towards real on both of
these. I have to say, I have loved so many of these leaks from Rage 2 to Forza Horizons 5 to some of this stuff.
So here's Nintendo. So the first thing is Retro Studios, which, kind of back in the news lately because of Donkey Kong Country Tropical Freeze getting its re-release. That was their last game, 2014. Retro Studios, of course, is the studio in Austin, Texas that did Metroid Prime 1, 2, 3. They then did Donkey Kong Country Returns and Tropical Freeze. They don't make a ton of games. When they do, they are solid gold. Yeah. Like, they have, I think, one of the best track records of the 21st century. They are 5 for 5.
Yeah, one thing important to mention is that while Metroid Prime 4 was announced, we knew that it was not them. So, like, that was already known, that it was not going to be done by them.
But that led to a lot of speculation, because for years, we knew Retro was working. They're not shut down. They are a Nintendo, like, second party. Like, they are working with Nintendo, but we didn't know on what. And this report came out that Retro Studios is developing a Star Fox racing game for Nintendo Switch called Star Fox Grand Prix The plan apparently is for it to be one of the big reveals at their E3 show, which means it's coming out this year because Nintendo has already said they're only focusing on games coming out this year. And when this was reported, like, one website that didn't seem very reliable broke it, and then it turned out every video game journalist on Earth knew this was happening.
Yeah, it was just this, like, entire, like, all of video game Twitter just went like, oh yeah,
Yeah, I've heard about that, yeah. I'm like, you all kept that amazingly secret.
It seemed like apparently nobody had mentioned it to anybody else. So there's like whatever. It feels like everyone was working on that story independently, like right at the same time. It's like, oh, wait, okay, shit, must be real. Yeah.
Jason Schreier at Kotaku said that Retro, what he's heard is that this is not the game Retro has been working on for 4 years.
Yeah, there was another project that was troubled at some point and got canceled. Was the scuttlebutt.
But yeah, so Star Fox Grand Prix is what they're making. It sounds like they're taking inspiration from Diddy Kong Racing, which is a Donkey Kong Country-esque game I still have yet to play, but everyone swears by that game. It's an N64-era kart racer that really is not a Mario Kart clone, even though it kind of looks like it, and it has this whole adventure mode with a campaign, and it's very experimental. People really liked that game. That was one of Rare's last Nintendo games. And so, yeah, it's a weird thing, because I think if on the surface you just heard without any other details Nintendo is making Star Fox Grand Prix, you'd all be like, that's the fucking dumbest idea. But when you hear Retro Studios, one of their absolute best developers, is making it, they kind of are going in this Diddy Kong Racing direction. You think how Star Fox has not been able to find its footing for a very, 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 very long time. It's like, you know, that's crazy enough to work. That's like, that's nutty. That sounds actually kind of good. Yeah. I'm kind of buzzed for this. That sounds good.
The other side of it is I just feel the utmost sympathy for F-Zero fans.
Yeah, yeah.
You're never getting your video game.
No,
the fact that if I'm just going to assume that this is true because it seems plausible enough to me. If Rage 2 is a thing, this fucking video game has got to exist, right?
Yeah.
It feels like, Nintendo, you have your, like, space racing franchise. Like, that's already a thing, and there are people that really love those F-Zero games that have gotten jack shit from Nintendo since, like, the GameCube. And it's like, there has got to be, like, one person that is just, like, holding on so tight. That's like, the rumors are, like, half true. Like, it's true that Retro is making a space racing game for Nintendo, but it's not Star Fox. You people, like, that's just, like, code name. It's really F-Zero. It's got to be. If someone is holding on to that dream, you have to let it go. They're never making another F-Zero
game.
Here's
my hope, is that they do the full reveal. People are like, that looks cool. And then their, like, little bonus thing on it is like, and we're going to have special day one DLC where you can play as Captain Falcon in Star Fox Grand Prix, just to rub the salt in the wound a little bit.
Yeah. But it's only Captain Falcon, because that's the only F-Zero character that anybody knows and cares about, because of Smash Brothers.
F-Zero, I mean, people have been born and gone through puberty in the time since there was an F-Zero game.
That's 100% true. I have taught fucking Romeo and Juliet and suffered through fucking terrible Romeo and Juliet movie with people who were born after the last fucking F-Zero game. So
it has been a long time.
Uh-huh.
All right. Also somewhat widespread reports that a Pokemon game is being developed for Switch for release later this year called Pokemon Let's Go Pikachu Edition and Pokemon Let's Go Eevee Edition, both of which are ostensibly remakes of Pokemon Yellow, thus set in the Kanto region, with some Pokemon Go mechanics and crossover material. New characters, the original trainers, Red and Blue, would be returning characters, so they have all these details on it. A potential logo was leaked. And what's weird is that this one also, a lot of people in the games industry were like, yeah, I've kind of heard rumblings about this. It lines up with some mysterious images Pokemon creators, like people at the Pokemon company, including the director of Pokemon, had been sharing online. Like here's a shot with Pikachu. Like, there had been a lot of pictures of Pikachu and Eevee, and no one could figure out why.
Yeah.
And so it kind of lines up. This one might even, one of the initial rumors that they might reveal this one even before E3. It's been a couple days. I kind of don't think that's going to happen because we're getting closer and closer every day.
Yeah.
I also think some people were depressed about this. Like, oh, does that mean we're not getting our full cool console? I don't think that's necessarily what this means. I think the Pokemon company probably is planning their next full generation. But I think we knew that probably wasn't coming this year.
Yeah.
This feels like a stopgap thing. I think the question is, will this be a Pokemon Go clone kind of thing just for an actual video game system, or will it be a real video game with some Pokemon Go integration? The latter sounds pretty fun.
Yes.
The former sounds stupid.
Yes.
And yeah. I guess that's where I leave it at. I don't know. I think if Nintendo puts it on their actual system, it'll be a more fully fleshed out thing, you know, because they don't have much of a history of putting that kind of thing on their own, like, hardware.
Yeah.
But we'll see. It's a brave new world. You know, we got fucking mobile apps.
Yeah, Pokemon Go was, like, that weird hot, like, that's going to be the thing that, like, you know, if, like, VH1 exists in the post-apocalypse or whatever, it'll be, like, the fucking, like, 2010s. Fucking, like, I love the 2010s, whatever the fuck they did, about, like, nostalgia. It's gonna be like, and Pokemon Go was so fucking hot, and everyone was walking around catching Pokemon.
They'll show that clip of Hillary Clinton saying, Pokemon Go to the polls.
Yes. Like, it was this weird, embarrassing cultural moment we had, and we all want to forget about it, but it would make a lot of sense for the Pokemon company to mind that. Because I agree with you that it has always seemed absurd to me that I have seen a lot of Pokemon fans online, like, desperately clinging to this idea that there's going to be, like, the new Pokemon generation is going to, like, come out this year. That game is going to come out this year. It's like, if it does, I don't think it would be the thing you'd want it to be. Because it's like, you want big HD, like, 720p fucking Pokemon game on the Nintendo Switch that takes advantage of everything the Nintendo Switch has to offer. That's not a game you can fucking pump out in, like, 2 or 3
also,
years.
Also, the Pokemon company has never done a Pokemon game at the very beginning of a console's lifespan.
Yeah.
This would be unusually early. They usually wait a couple of years. Like when the 3DS came out, the 3DS came out a month after Black and White on the DS.
Yeah.
You know, Gold and Silver came out. I played those on the GBA. Like, that's when they came out. Like, that's what they do. They kind of wait. This would be more consistent with that strategy of, like, in the background, they are working on, because they have to work it for the new hardware. They always have to do that.
Yeah.
And it's a big reconfiguration of what the game is. But this feels like, they do frequently, however, do a testing the waters game. This feels like the testing the waters game. Again, I think it could be pretty cool. If there's some light Pokemon Go integration that you could ignore if you don't play Pokemon Go, but otherwise it's a fun Pokemon remake with your characters, and they said, you know, your Pokemon will follow you along. I've always liked that. That's cool. Like, this could be really neat. We'll see. I have an open mind about it. I don't know. Nintendo, like, Pokemon has had some spin-offs and stuff over the years.
Yeah.
But they're generally pretty big, meaty experiences. Pokemon is, and this is true of most Nintendo franchises, these are not franchises they kind of just fuck around with casually with some of these games. And I would be surprised if they do that here.
Make Pokemon Snap 2.
That would be great.
That is my demand.
Not going to happen.
It's not going to fucking happen. I mean, they made a console, the Wii U, that felt like it was designed to be, like, the vehicle for Pokemon Snap 2, and they didn't fucking do it. Fuck you. Snap 2 on the Wii U.
All right.
I might find one in the garbage can somewhere and play it.
Well, that's the news for this week.
Sean, speaking of garbage cans,
we like Deadpool 2.
But that seems like something like Deadpool would throw his own movie in the garbage
can. It would. So let's talk Deadpool 2. Spoilers from here on out. If you haven't seen Deadpool 2, again, you look at the money. I think if you want to see Deadpool 2, you've seen it.
Yeah.
But, you know, if not, spoilers in a couple, you know, 5, 4, 3, 2, blood ever.
He breaks the fourth wall.
He does. He does. That's a spoiler.
Yeah. It's irreverent humor.
Sean, I was surprised at how much I liked Deadpool 2.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, me too.
It's really good.
Yes.
Like, really good. Like, I went to see it as the double feature they did Thursday night because my brother, Thomas, had not seen the first movie yet. And so I thought, oh, this is easy. We can go to this double feature and he'll get to see the first one and then the second one. And it was interesting for me because I have not seen the first Deadpool since it first came out. And I liked that movie at the time with reservations. I think you were the same way.
Yeah.
And I watched it a second time here and I'm like, this is still good. I think, you know, what was good about that movie is Ryan Reynolds was born to play Deadpool. His enthusiasm shines through. I think it's got an interesting structure. I think it makes good use of the ancillary characters. Again, Colossus eating cereal at the mansion,
yeah,
which you noted was the most comic booky thing in a comic book movie up to that point.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we've surpassed it with, like, Infinity War and some of that.
Yes,
but,
yeah.
But it was still so cool. I also think that movie gets bogged down in the origin story. I think its low-budget charms are often apparent, but also sometimes limited in some ways.
It has that really gross-looking, like, cloudy day vehicle chase that still is, like, the most grimy-looking thing I've ever seen in a movie.
Yeah, you know, I think it's good for what it is. It's a good setup. But I remember just from the moment I saw it, it's like, I want to see Deadpool 2 because I want to see if they'll do more with this. And they do. Like, Deadpool 2 is not a rest on your laurels sequel. It's not going to be for everyone. Like, way more even than the first one. Like, it is confident in what it is and what it wants to do. Sometimes amazingly brazenly so in, like, how they handle X-Force in this movie, which is fucking amazing. But I think this movie, I found it surprising in a lot of the directions it takes in good ways. I think it's tremendously acted by everyone on board. Ryan Reynolds, Josh Brolin is a great addition. All the returning players love Negasonic Teenage Warhead and her cool girlfriend, Yukio, who has a great relationship. Hi, Wade. Hi, Yukio. I love all that. Yeah. That's great. You know, just all the characters are really good. I think it tells a really interesting story. This, to me, was the most surprising thing about it. It is an even more irreverent and crazy movie than Deadpool 1, and yet it's a better, like, more heartfelt, weirdly, story.
Yeah.
It gives Deadpool an arc, and I think we're going to talk about that a lot, and I think the way it does that without undermining who Deadpool is a fucking magic trick. Like, I wrote this on Twitter, that would be like making a Looney Tunes movie where Bugs Bunny grows as a character and is still Bugs Bunny. And it's hard to imagine, right? Because he's a fucking cartoon. And the third thing, Tim Miller did a good job on Deadpool 1 as the director, but David Leitch is trading up.
Yeah.
He is David Leitch. I don't know how you say his last name. He was one of the co-directors of John Wick 1, and then he and Chad Stahelski, the other director, split off. Chad Stahelski did John Wick 2 and now 3. David Leitch did Deadpool 2. And, of course, if you know them, they are longtime Hollywood stunt guys. They were Keanu Reeves' stunt team on The Matrix. They know what they're doing, and I think the directorial step up in this movie is out of this world. The way David Leitch, like, directs action, he and Chad Stahelski are just, in terms of, like, American filmmaking, they're kind of the best at this right now.
Yeah.
The kineticism of it, the creativity of it, but also in this case, because John Wick, those movies are funny, but they're not comedies. Some of the jokes that are staged in this movie are fucking Rube Goldbergian in how fucking complex they are and how much directorial skill it takes to pull those off.
Yeah.
Like the entire X-Force sequence. So I'm very impressed with this movie.
Yeah, I liked it a lot. I think obviously it's way better than the first movie. And I think it is that it has a really strong balance between, like, it's obviously, it is a comedy, first and foremost. Like, it is you're coming to this movie for the comedy, and I think it's very funny, but it does wrap that around a strong core story for Deadpool, where, as you said, he grows, there's, like, a proper story arc, it's got a good, tight story structure. I think there are some issues I have with it, but generally speaking, like you, it feels like it's kind of like going above and beyond my expectations. Like, I'm not a huge Deadpool guy. That the first Deadpool movie surprised me by how much I enjoyed it. This one, like, surprised me even more. This is, I think, probably pretty easily my favorite Deadpool thing I've ever seen. And yeah, I think it's really good.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, again, with that story stuff, because when Deadpool 1, like, settles down to tell a story, the problem is it stops telling jokes. I noticed that when I watched it again, that, like, there is that solid half hour in the middle where it is just all flashback telling the rest of his origin story. It's the stuff with him at the weird laboratory with Francis and all the torture stuff, and then how he becomes Deadpool and how he escapes. And it's kind of like 25, 30 minutes where they don't tell jokes. Like, there's little quips, but, like, they don't do any fun gags. Deadpool doesn't get to be irreverent. It's just kind of serious and it's boring. This movie has a good balance. It never stops telling jokes, really, but when it wants to get serious and have Deadpool have a character, it can do that. And I don't even say get serious. I think there is one moment late in the movie that is serious. Spoilers, you know, it's him and Vanessa kind of reuniting in the afterlife that I found kind of surprisingly affecting of, like, it makes you realize how much you've actually come to care for Wade Wilson as a character. But other than that, they never really stop telling jokes. And you're able to build that character through the comedy and build the comedy through the character. And that is, it's not unheard of or anything. That's what good comedies do. Yeah. But it takes an awful lot of skill. And I think this movie is really skillfully made.
Yes. And then also, like with the first Deadpool, I think the Deadpool franchise continues. Like, I'm not saying that these are the best movies starring X-Men characters, because that's, like, Logan is easily the best one of these. But this is, I think, so far the best X-Men movie. In the sense of, like, like, one, the fucking whole theme is, like, family. It's, like, putting the team together and creating, like, a family in this team. And it makes the best use of X-Men characters, both better-known characters like Colossus and the surprise appearance of Juggernaut, which is fucking awesome. And then, like, more obscure characters like Negasonic Teenage Warhead and Domino that is so good in this movie.
Domino's
like,
really, so
they fucking nailed that character so well. It's just, like, it's so ridiculous to me. And it's something that I think maybe my favorite joke of this whole movie, maybe we kind of should start here because I want to talk about like some of the larger X-Men stuff before we get super deep into this movie. The best joke in this movie is when Deadpool is at the mansion and he's talking to Colossus and he's complaining about how none of like the real X-Men show up. And then there's this shot of Beast and like all the other like Cyclops and everybody from that are going to be
James McAvoy's in it.
Yeah, James McAvoy and like all the people that are going to that were in like the last X-Men movie and are going to be in Dark Phoenix and stuff like are there and Beast like comes up and shuts the door and like that's the best joke both because it's just like the way it's staged and written and everything is really fucking funny and like just the use of cameo and it's the really good like fourth wall breaking. But also, it, like, reminds me of, like, I don't give a shit about that side of X-Men anymore. Like, there was a time with, like, X-Men First Class and Days of Future Past, they were doing it, but it's, like, they just shot such a huge fucking bullet in the head of that franchise with Apocalypse and, like, just the general mishandling of it, that, like, Deadpool is so much better at using these characters than those movies have ever been.
Here's my thought on it. I wrote this on Twitter, too. Part of why both Deadpool 1 and Deadpool 2 work, and 2 to an even fiercer extent, why they work is they know the X-Men franchise is fucking terrible on film. Like, there are some good X-Men movies. I think X2 is really good. I think First Class is pretty good. I think Days of Future Past has its moments. You've got your recent experiments like Logan, which Logan is the best movie of any of these, but I think you can almost like put that on an island over here.
Yeah, it's because it's not an X-Men movie. It's a Wolverine. Kind of like Wolverine, the one where he goes to Japan. Like, it's those are Wolverine movies, yeah. Not X-Men movies.
And even that one gets tripped up in some X-Men things, right? But no, on the whole, like, Deadpool knows, like, it makes no goddamn sense continuity. It has been all over the place quality-wise. For the majority of the life of this franchise, they were completely afraid to embrace anything comic booky about them, which is a huge problem in all the movies up to kind of Deadpool 1 and maybe the Japanese Wolverine 1. I mean, they all, like, First Class does, but, like, it more embraces that Matthew Vaughn is getting to make a James Bond movie more than it does, like, I want to do a cool movie with Banshee? No one cares, right? Was he one of them?
Yes. Okay. You were right. I had forgotten.
Yeah.
You were right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, and like, and Jennifer Lawrence is in it playing Mystique, I guess. I guess it's technically Mystique.
And Deadpool 2, because Deadpool 1 was so successful, it gets to just rub the franchise's nose in it that the way to do this is to actually do it. Because you know, there have been a lot of surprising comic book movies in recent years, like Thor Ragnarok and Guardians of the Galaxy and Doctor Strange. I still think on some level Deadpool is the most surprising, both because of what it is and that it actually got made by Fox, but also that it has been so successful, you know?
Yeah.
Like, people really wanted it, loved it, there's a rabid fan base for it, and part of that is that, you know, Deadpool was kind of the ultimate antithesis to how they were doing X-Men up to that point. Like, if you look at the early X-Men movies, they were so afraid of being comic book movies because Tom Rothman, the head of Fox at the time, hated comic books but wanted to make money, and so you got black leather spandex for everyone, you know? And Deadpool just has fun with it, and it's all over this movie. I think that's a great joke about it. I think a lot of what they do with, like, they're making fun of Logan, that it starts with the joke about how Wolverine died and just clear the air on that. The post-credits scenes are fucking savage, and I love it. I mean, Ryan Reynolds saves many of his biggest jokes for himself, which is great.
Yeah.
Just that it is completely irreverent on the timeline. You know, it's all of it. I think part of it is that it has fun with the idea that this is a broken franchise that it's getting to play in, and Deadpool is a good guy to play in a broken franchise.
Yeah. And just that, like, outside of Xavier, Magneto, and Wolverine from the older X-Men movies, and Xavier and Magneto in kind of both their forms, because I think they've always done good by those characters. But, like, Xavier and Magneto are not the X-Men. So it's like while it's awesome that you did well by those characters, like, they're not the X-Men. And then Wolverine is one of the X-Men that was his best when he got to make his own movies. I mean, they fucked up on the first one. But, you know, the other two, like, the second one is pretty good, and the third one is fucking great. So it's like, Outside of that, none of the other X-Men have ever been interesting in any of these movies. Like, they just have never done it well. Like, there's some that, like, I kind of like Nightcrawler from X2.
I think Rebecca Romijn's Mystique was always good.
Yeah, also not an X-Men, though. Like, no, she's true. Another she's one as a villain. Yeah. So it's like they just have never done that. It's like no, they've
Cyclops
never quite
has been
it.
Bad twice.
Yeah.
Jean Grey has been bad once and then was in, like, 5 minutes of another movie and already became Phoenix, so who gives a shit?
Yeah, like, they've never really committed to doing Iceman, like, you know, even, like, Rogue as, like, your vague sort of, like, POV character from the earlier movies is, like...
Rogue is good because of Anna Paquin, not because of any
writing. Yeah, nothing about the characters, it just, it's just, like, the performance is pretty compelling. But, it's like, they've just never made any interesting fucking X-Men characters other than Wolverine that are actually an X-Men. And even Wolverine's, like, a weird X-Man. Like, he's... Wolverine is like an X-Men with like an asterisk, basically, because he's like a weird short Canadian hairy dude that like is around when he wants to be and then just fucks off and does other shit when he doesn't. And this movie has Deadpool, who's like basically an X-Men trainee, but he's an X-Men, you know.
They remind him frequently he's a trainee.
It's like Cable is, even though they don't get into this, Cable is like the son or grandson of Cyclops, so it's like he's an honorary X-Men by blood. But then it's like, but then you have fucking Domino, X-Man, you have Negasonic Teenage Warhead, X-Man, and you have fucking Colossus, again, so good. It's like, actually, like, they're actual X-Men characters that are, like, the good guys that team together and have, like, different interests and competing personalities, but find, like, a common middle ground and form a team together by the end. It's like... How come none of the fucking... And you've made so many X-Men movies. None of them have done that. Not a single fucking one other than Deadpool 2, which isn't even an X-Men movie and isn't even, like, advertised as a team-up movie.
Because the good X-Men movies are the ones that basically just take the characters they know work, which is basically just, you know, Wolverine,
Xavier
and Magneto, and, like, put them at the center. Like, X2 does that and works. X-Men Days of Future Past... They just ditch the rest of the team. You just pretend Mystique is a different character, and you're pretty much good.
Yeah.
But they had to bring Wolverine fucking back because they had nothing else to go on. Like, a lot of this, it's just... you're totally right. And the other part is that they also, I think, make great fun of it in... They not just they do the X-Men thing well, as you're saying, but they also then pick a couple of E or F-list X-Men and just kill them in the middle of the movie for comedy.
Yeah.
To also point out how lame so many of these characters are.
God, what they do with Shatterstar is the weird alien dude is
oh, it's the best.
The best. It's so good.
The whole
X-Force, such a dick.
Can I talk about the X-Force joke now?
Yes.
Just
because
it's later in the movie. I have to talk about it because Ryan Reynolds is not just good at... playing, and in this case, writing, because he co-wrote the movie Deadpool. He is also so good at marketing Deadpool. And part of this is that for years, Ryan Reynolds has been talking up how, well, Deadpool is kind of the first step. We want to do an X-Force movie, because Deadpool is part of X-Force, and we're going to build up X-Force. Everyone loves X-Force, you know, cool 90s thing.
Yeah.
And we're going to introduce X-Force in Deadpool 2. And we're probably not even going to... He said this in an interview. He said, we're probably not going to do Deadpool 3, because we're going to have to do the X-Force movie. And, you know, that'll be our cool team-up, and that's the next thing we're going to do. And I just, now you go back and look at it, and you know Ryan Reynolds inside was cackling because what they actually do with X-Force in this movie is Deadpool, kind of on a whim, he probably doesn't actually need the team to go do this, but he thinks it will be cool. You know, Cable is out there, he needs to fight Cable, so he wants to put together a team. So he and TJ Miller interview a bunch of people, they get a stupid team together made up of most of the worst X-Men, plus Domino, who is cool, and the Invisible Person, which is great.
The Vanisher.
That Vanisher, which was you never see until he gets electrocuted and it's Brad Pitt. And then you have Peter, the just random guy who comes in off the street. And Deadpool makes X-Force. And then they dive out. And for about 5 minutes, they're building up. Everyone is talking about the high wind advisory. And you're wondering, where is this going? And what happens is, on the way down to Earth, almost every one of them, except Domino and Deadpool, dies in horrible, graphic ways.
Yeah.
Including, as you were saying, Shatterstock. What happens to
Shatterstar? Shatterstar. One that gets sucked into the helicopter blades, and you see that because he's the alien, so he has the like green blood.
And doesn't weird. And then Peter goes over to like talk to him, and doesn't it like the acid like burn off his arm?
Yeah, no, that's Zeitgeist.
That's the other guy
that vomits up acid. Yes, and he's trying to pull him out of like the trash compactor or something. He vomits on Peter because at first, like, I was actually pretty convinced that Peter was going to live.
Yeah, I was too.
Yeah. But, like, the other thing that they do to really sell that joke to me is that the first one is Terry Crews.
Terry Crews, as Bedlam. Yes.
And I was like, because I didn't know that he was in the movie.
So neither
like,
did I.
Like, Terry Crews shows up, like, awesome. I did no idea he was going to be in this movie. Sure, it's very Terry fucking Crews. Everybody loves Terry Crews. He's got to be in like, the movie for like a decent chunk here. And I think he's the first to
die. He's the first to die. He gets sucked into the turbine, and then Vanisher hits the electrical wires, and he comes up and hits Brad Pitt for one frame, and dies. And I guess I also got to say why I find this so overwhelmingly funny is, I think it's because of some of the kinds of comedy I was raised on. I think comedic violence could be one of the funniest things in the world if you do it right.
Yeah.
It takes skill. Like, and I actually think Deadpool 1 kind of, sometimes it does its comedic violence well, like the thing where he's punching Colossus and slowly breaks every bone in his body, which is very Monty Python-esque. And some of the other comedic violence, not so much. Like, if it's just like a geyser of blood, that alone is not funny. This is funny comedic violence. Because, as I said, it's this giant Rube Goldberg contraption of a joke. Where you have to first set up that X-Force is a thing. You have to make Deadpool excited about it. You have to be in a climate of everyone's doing team-up movies. You have to know the conventions of these X-Men films.
I mean, they have the fucking whole, like, Predator scene on the fucking, like helicopter or whatever when they're in, like, the bay. And it's like, they're all, like military dudes. Like, yeah, we're going to X-Force! It's like, they do the whole thing.
Yes, and then kill all of them in just visually creative, hilarious ways. And Deadpool 2 does this consistently. It is so good at comedic violence. It is like, you know, if the best comedic violence ever is probably like Monty Python and the Holy Grail and the Black Knight getting all his limbs chopped off, this is like near that level consistently of like funny comedic violence because of, I think, like where it comes from in the storytelling. And in the middle of this whole sequence, you have Domino and our first look at her luck powers.
Yeah.
And the way, like, David Leitch has so much fun staging all of those scenes where she's, you know, running around and just everything falls into place for her. Those are just amazing pieces of kinetic cinema. I love all of that.
Yeah, and then all the while, like, Deadpool narrating, it's like, no, it's, like, Lux, but, like, that's not a real superpower. Even if it was, it wouldn't be very cinematic, like, right as, like, the coolest shot in the movie happens. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's all very good.
Yeah, I should say right now, the actress who plays Domino is Zazie Beetz, who has been in some other stuff, I know, but this was, I think, my first time seeing her. She's in Atlanta, the Donald Glover show.
Right, yeah.
She's so great. She's just amazing. I hope she is a consistent part of this franchise moving forward.
Yes, me too.
She kind of steals the show in a lot of ways. But I guess, so, comedic violence is funny. Getting back to some big picture stuff.
Okay.
Like what you were talking about, that it is kind of an X-Men movie. Like, it puts a team together, and it has interesting X people. And, what surprised me, I guess, about that is because of the marketing and because of, I think, the shadow this character casts in Deadpool fandom, I thought this was going to be more of the Cable movie.
Me too, yeah.
And I wouldn't have minded that. I like the way, like, I knew nothing about Cable. I came out of this movie a Cable fan. He's a cool character, as played by Josh Brolin. But it's not the Cable movie. Like, Cable is a big part of the movie. He's one of the animating forces that gets the plot going. But even at, like, his heaviest use in the film, he's a member of the ensemble. He's not, like, you know, main character number two.
Yeah, it doesn't do the, like, buddy cop-ish thing that is what, like, the Deadpool-Cable dynamic is from the comic books, from what I've read. And you get, like, hints of it here, but because they're at odds for almost the whole movie, it's not till, like, the third act that they kind of come together. And even then, like, you know, they only come together in the third act, so it's, like, them establishing their relationship. That's where you get some of that, like, Deadpool being the straight man and Deadpool being the goofball, or Cable being the straight man, Deadpool being the goofball, and that dynamic works really well, and it makes me excited for the next movie.
Yeah.
But I think they were smart in saying, like, we'll use this movie to sort of establish that relationship, but that's not enough to carry the whole film. And so having a larger ensemble around that works really well.
Yeah, because what they do, I mean, for one, Josh Brolin is great.
Yeah.
He comes on screen, he is that character.
Yeah, he commits to it 100%, which is noble.
And also, Josh Brolin is funny. Like, this is something not enough people know about Josh Brolin. If you want to know why Josh Brolin is funny, go watch the movie Inherent Vice. Best film of 2014, watch the whole movie because it's great. But if you want to watch one scene, just Google Josh Brolin chocolate banana. Mm-hmm. There's a scene where he eats a chocolate banana in Inherent Vice, and it is the funniest fucking thing in the world. And it's maybe not even the funniest scene with him in that movie. He is so great. But he always plays it straight. He never looks like he's making a joke, but he's obviously a funny actor to be able to do that. And he does that a lot in Deadpool 2, and just like how he kind of holds himself on screen around the other characters. And I think they get a lot of narrative mileage out of him being, he's not really the antagonist of the movie, but antagonistic early on, and then how he joins up. I think that one of the other funniest scenes in the movie is when he comes to meet Deadpool, and that's also the scene where Deadpool is growing back the bottom half of his body and does the basic instinct thing where he moves his leg and you see his little boy penis.
Yeah.
That whole sequence is amazing. And he, like, stands up and walks over to Cable. Anyway, all of that's funny. But they use Cable well. But what it ultimately is, and this is a through line with how they use every character in the movie, is it's Deadpool's story.
Yeah.
And just getting into the main plot of the movie, normally, starting the movie with killing the girlfriend character, the Morena Baccarin character in this case, that would annoy the shit out of me. Yeah. And I'll admit, when the movie started, you used to have that first montage with the song 9 to 5 of him doing jobs, which, A plus choice of music throughout this whole movie.
Absolutely,
yeah. And that's a great one as well. But then he comes home, she gets offed, and I was like, that's annoying, that's a lazy thing to do. But here's the thing, I actually think they earn it over the course of the movie, and they do something with it. You know, there is the basic, I guess, practical thing of, like, what is a Deadpool movie if he is happily married with kids? That does not seem like a very ripe angle to do a Deadpool story. So there's that. But I also, I think I knew we were in good hands as soon as. So she dies, he's going and fighting the guy, he gets hit by the truck, and we cut to the credits. And I knew they knew what they were doing when they were doing this, like, really cheesy James Bond parody opening sequence. I was howling with laughter like a lunatic. That is probably the hardest I laughed at the movie, is the way they do the parody of the James Bond, like, especially modern James Bond, like, with the, like, kaleidoscope of Deadpools coming out, and they have this, like, cheesy song playing over it, and they do the thing from the first movie with the humorous credits, which I thought worked. They did it very well here, because this is how I knew they were doing it. They had the funny James Bond thing, and then the, like, something-something presents... Wait, did you just kill her?
Yeah.
And, like, they go through all of that to directed by one of the guys who killed John Wick's dog.
Yeah.
Which was pretty great. And then coming back from that and him trying to kill himself with all the gasoline barrels and kind of where they take the story of him being paired with this kid in a way that is an interesting complement to the movie Logan, which we can talk about, but it is not the same plot of Logan. I think by the time you get to the end of the movie and he has, like, his, like, beyond the grave, reunion with the Morena Baccarin character, I was like, okay, they actually told a story with this. Like, they did fridge the wife, and it's a problem. But, like, they did make a story out of it, and I think this was probably the right story to tell for this character in this setting. So I was surprised at how well that worked.
Yeah, I think they pulled it off really well. I don't know if it was something they needed to do, I think there might have been better ways to do it. Because I think it's one of the small issues I have with the movie is I think, like, the connection between, like, Deadpool and Vanessa, or Wade and Vanessa, Vanessa, like, deciding, like, oh, okay, like, let's have children, to then, like, the Fire Fist character. What's his actual name? Russell. Because I don't want to call him Fire Fist for the whole fucking thing. And Russell being this, like, troubled kid. I think, like, there's some, like, missing story thread there that I feel like they're sort of, like, implying there's, like, a connection there that I think, like, needs to be stronger to sort of, like, really make the justification. I think they could have done a little bit more there, and it's probably, for me, the weakest bit of plotting in the movie. But they do it the best that I think they could have.
You know, I see the connection between, like, Russell and Wade Wilson as, like, people who meet. Yeah. I agree, there's probably some better writing you could have done to get that connection between that and then Vanessa and how he's living up or down to that. But I don't know, it kicks you into the movie with a motivation. And yes, it's the let's kick a puppy easy motivation thing to get something going. But it's still, I don't know, I was still impressed by it. I think in part because of the hugely tongue-in-cheek nature of the way these movies work, they can kind of sell that better because it is also a cliche they're playing on. They do probably try to have their cake and eat it with that.
Yeah, that's kind of how I feel about it.
Yeah. I do think also, if we're talking about plotting, I think the movie is generally pretty well paced. Like, it moves. This felt faster than a lot of maybe similar 2-hour-ish superhero movies would. Yeah. I do think the first act has to go through a lot of shoe leather to get the plot going. She has to die, which is all the opening sequence before you even get to the title screen. And then Wade has to be sad, and he goes to the X-Mansion with Colossus, and they have all the X-trainee stuff, and that's where he meets Russell, and then he kills the dudes, and so he and Russell go to the icebox, and that's where Cable comes in. So, like, it takes a while for Cable to enter the story. I don't know where I would have cleaned any of that up, and each of those scenes on their own is tremendously entertaining. Like, all the stuff where he goes to the X-Mansion, as you said, phenomenal jokes there. I love the whole relationship between him and Colossus, of Colossus just always will give this dude one more chance when he knows he shouldn't, because he's fucking Deadpool. And I just, the whole scene where Deadpool goes to meet Firefist, you know, Russell, and is pretending to be an X-Men or a trainee X-Men as Negasonic Teenage Warhead constantly reminds him, is a fantastic scene. And again, in terms of good use of comedic violence, setting us up for Deadpool is going to do a redemptive act, and his redemptive act is he's going to start shooting people in the head. A+.
Yes.
Very good. And I just, and I love what it does to, like, start out that Russell Deadpool relationship, in that they are literally both thrown in the clink together, of like, they are both sort of X people, they're mutants, but they just don't belong in this society. And, you know, putting Deadpool down to, like, his lowest point. There's a lot of good stuff there.
But I do think I agree with you that there is too much, like, material that needs to. And I think that's one of the reasons why, like, the killing Vanessa thing, I think there were, like, other ways to do something to, like, put their relationship at odds that isn't, like, this big dramatic bomb at the beginning of the movie. Because I think part of it is that the Deadpool going to the X-Men and being the trainee and going to the icebox, like, that stuff doesn't feel as immediately connected to the Vanessa stuff as it could have. Because like, normally that plot device is used to set up a revenge plot. This movie is not a revenge story at all. And so it's like there's some other step that needed to be happen to bridge those two concepts. If you're going to have a revenge movie opening but not having a revenge movie plot, you have to do something to connect that for me. And that's like the one thing that the movie never really does.
What are the chances that it was floated in the room writing that Deadpool has a dog in this and the dog gets killed and that's why he goes off? Just as, like, just to make it full meta.
Yes.
Someone pitched that.
Someone must have pitched it. I suspect that maybe that was something that they're, like, either too late in the process to actually do that opening, or they're, like, the studio heads or someone is, like, no, you can't. No.
Yeah.
No.
I don't think there was a lot they were told no to on this movie.
Well, some of the stuff maybe they didn't say. Maybe they, like, put in any script that they were going to use stock footage from X-Men Origins and kill Ryan Reynolds from that movie. I don't know if anybody at Fox knew that happened.
I mean, it's a completely different, like, head structure at Fox. And also, Fox is a company on its way out the door. So, like,
yes.
I mean, this movie does have kind of a burn the doors down feeling to it, because it is going to be the last Fox Deadpool movie.
That's true.
So, I mean, I think it's kind of up in the air what Disney will do with this franchise. That's so fucking weird that Disney's going to own Deadpool.
Yes.
That is one of the weirder things to think about.
I don't like the mega corporation world we live in now.
No. Anyway.
It frightens me.
Yes. But I do like all of that. Russell as a character, I think, works really well.
Yeah.
Again, if on paper you told me Deadpool 2, they're going to pair him with a kid and it's going to be that plot, I'm like, what the fuck are you talking about, would be my thought.
Yeah.
But one, they had Julian Dennison, very good young actor. I have not seen this movie yet, but I know he was discovered in the film Hunt for the Wilder People, which is a film by the director of Thor Ragnarok, Taika Waititi.
Right,
it's what he did before Thor Ragnarok. Very acclaimed film. Julian Dennison was acclaimed in that, and kind of the perfect kid you need for this, because he has natural comic timing. He is able to kind of take the piss out of himself the way everyone else in the movie does.
Yeah.
I think he plays the emotional beats well, because there's some dark stuff going on with that
character. Yeah, I think he does really pull it off well when at the end of the movie he has to, like, go full, like, goth, like, burn it all down mode. I think he lands that, like, dramatic turn.
I like all the stuff he does. I like the way he kind of cozies up to Juggernaut before we know he's Juggernaut, and you're just waiting the whole time, like, which X-Men are they going to pull out of there?
Yeah.
But yeah, I liked him. I think he was a good addition to the movie, and yeah, I agree there's some places where they could connect things thematically maybe better, but I like that giving Deadpool this, like, just one, like, crumb of a motivation of something good and selfless to do. Of like, yeah. I don't want this kid to turn out bad, and I don't want Cable to just shoot him. Deadpool obviously has a lot of mayhem in his wake in this film. He probably, on the whole, does more harm than good to the world.
Oh, yes.
But, like...
Peter didn't deserve what happened to him, you know? No. Like, I would take Peter over fucking Russell any day of the week, okay?
Yes. But, at the end of the day, that Deadpool is on this mission to, like, do this one good thing does give the movie this nice heft to all of it that, like, takes you through it all and makes the jokes... Honestly, it makes the jokes all the more funny that, like... all these X-Force people die out of genuinely good intentions on yes. Deadpool's part. Like, that's one of... I think that's just a rule of comedy, that if Deadpool has some kernel of good intentions, his fuck-ups are funnier.
Yeah.
And there's just... that's something that very much works for this movie. And then having Cable be the force that is after him in this very Terminator-esque way, all of that works great.
They showed a lot of restraint in only making what I spotted as one Terminator joke.
Yes.
He calls him Sarah Connor, John Connor, once.
Yes.
Which is actually not the right, because it's Kyle. He's the Kyle Reese equivalent. He's not John Connor.
Like, I noticed that too, yes, but, you know.
Like, John Connor doesn't fucking travel in time. Deadpool, watch a fucking movie.
Anyway, yes. But yeah, I liked... how those different parts of it connect. I think the last act is very well built too, where he's got his little team, his little band of rogues, and then he goes to the mansion, the X-Mansion, and holds up the little boombox for yeah. Colossus and gets Colossus to come back out. That was just, it was also kind of weirdly heartwarming because not so much for Deadpool's part in it, but you kind of want Colossus to have his faith restored.
Yes.
Because yeah. Colossus is such a good dude.
Yeah, when you see Colossus just, like, sulking in his bed, it felt really bad. Like, yeah. I felt like, oh, no. Like, you need to, come on, Colossus, like, pull yourself up, man. Like, you can do this. Like, one more ride.
Because it's true. Like, what would hurt Colossus most? It probably is him taking this guy under his wing and getting, like, people killed.
Yeah.
So, then you have the last act, and I think they just stage all the action so well. Again, like, connecting between different fights and parts of fights is very well done in this. I like Colossus fighting Juggernaut and everything going on in the mansion. The fight with Juggernaut and the score under it, they wrote that like weird choral piece. Yeah. Holy shit, it's yeah. Juggernaut. That was great. Talk about Juggernaut for a second, because that's one of yeah. the best things they did.
That's one of my... It was something that I had honestly forgotten about Juggernaut, even though when I read X-Men comics, he was one of my more favorite characters, like, from the cartoons. I always really liked Juggernaut, but they had him in, what was it, X-Men 3 that he yeah, was in, was the only movie he's been in.
And that's the one where he goes, I'm the Juggernaut, bitch.
Yes, that's when that was a meme still, which is, you know, like, way to date your fucking movie by yeah. throwing a fucking meme as, like, the only piece of dialogue that character gets. That's the least of X-Men 3's problems, but it is one of X-Men 3's problems. But yeah, like Juggernaut's just a big, fun villain. Now, obviously, they don't get into any of the stuff about how he's, like, Charles Xavier's brother. And, like, there's a lot of, like, drama that you can do.
Well, they do make a joke about it.
They do make a joke, yes.
Yeah, which was funny.
But they do, obviously, like, I would also like to see if, you know, in the endless score of mediocre X-Men movies, we're certainly going to continue to get... Juggernaut is a villain character that, like, actually has, like, dramatic potential that you can do shit with. But, yeah, that reveal, just because, like, it had completely left my mind that Juggernaut was ever a character they could use in these X-Men movies, because for whatever reason, they just never did. Even though he's one of the more famous X-Men villains outside of Magneto, it's like him and fucking Apocalypse are probably, like, right under Magneto for most recognizable X-Men villains. And yeah, when he just fucking pops out of that thing, it's like, oh my god, fuck yeah, Juggernaut! That's right, Juggernaut's super cool. And I also just love that Deadpool is a fan of Juggernaut, because like, that that's great. His thing, and it's like, he's a fan of Juggernaut from the comics as like a fourth wall breaking thing, which I hope that is just because Ryan Reynolds himself is a fan of Juggernaut. I feel like that must be where that joke comes from.
I think Ryan Reynolds is the real deal in terms of being a comic book fan.
No, absolutely.
I don't think I like anything as much as he likes Deadpool.
Yeah, I think that's a fair way to look at it. So I'm assuming, and it has to be true, and even if it's not true, I don't want to know because it makes me like it better, that all those references are in there because Ryan Reynolds just really likes fucking Juggernaut, and it was just like, awesome, we have Juggernaut in this movie. But in particular, I think the fucking Juggernaut Colossus fight is so good. It's such a good payoff for the Colossus character that he just decides to fight dirty at the end.
Yes.
It's that fusion of comedy and drama, of that it is a good sort of like culmination of that character, that he's this, like, kind of sees a little bit of Deadpool side, not enough to go around just murdering people, but he sees this, like, I need to relax a little bit, and just like, okay, it's time to fight dirty, like, let's do this fucking Soviet style, and just throw down, and he fucks Juggernaut up. Like, he gets fucked up at the beginning of the fight, but then once Colossus gets going, the shit he does is just so good.
Well, and then the payoff of having Megasonic Teenage Warhead and Yukio come in and use their powers to help him fuck up Juggernaut by shoving the cables up his ass.
Yes.
It's all very good.
It's very good. It's a great fight. It's well staged. I like that they sort of lampshade it as the big CGI fight while also having it be legitimately one of the best, like, big CGI fights in any of these superhero movies.
Yeah.
It's like two CGI characters going at each other, fucking like Batman v Superman, take some lessons, you know?
Yeah, I mean, and again, this is part of why this movie works so well, is that I think the action in the first movie is fine, it's decent, it's hyper-violent, but I don't think there's anything all that creative or special about it. David Leitch knows what he's doing. This is like getting, you know, like when Gene Kelly would direct, like, his own dancing movies or something, right? He's a dancer. He knows how to shoot it. He knows how to film it. This guy knows action. And there's just that kineticism to it. That whole orphanage fight at the end and how many places things are going on and how it's staged. It's very similar to, like, John Wick in terms of how fluid it is and how much it kind of has that energy where you can really see everything going on. The stunt work is good. It's kinetic and well-edited and put together. You know, it's something that doesn't escape every, you know, modern blockbuster. There are plenty that do good action, but I think there's some genuinely, like, great action in this movie, and that's the separation.
So, absolutely.
Yeah, that's really all so much fun. What else to talk about here? What other characters? We talked about Cable. We talked about Domino has all the fun powers, we said. Another shout out to Negasonic Teenage Warhead and Brianna Hildebrand. I still want more of her in these movies because she's fucking great and hilarious. I love all of that. I'm trying to think if there's anyone we've kind of missed here. There's, of course, Ryan Reynolds himself. I just want to say, I'm so surprised how much I like Ryan Reynolds in these movies.
Mm-hmm.
Ryan Reynolds is probably a little surprised how much we all like him in these movies. Because he had a very long, circuitous route to being the movie star he now is. In that he had to be in a lot of really bad movies. He had to kind of experiment with his screen persona in so many ways. And then he finally just got to make the movie his heart always wanted to make, clearly, which was his silly juvenile Deadpool movie. And he's great in it. Like, as good a match for this character as Hugh Jackman for Wolverine or Robert Downey Jr. for Tony Stark. Like, no one else is going to be able to do Deadpool live action after him. You know?
Yes.
He just gets it. He takes the piss out of himself so consistently in terms of his looks and his facade and all of that. What he does at the end of the movie with the Origins Wolverine thing was one joke that was great. But the Green Lantern joke, that was fucking savage. And I loved it. And knowing that, like, the X-Men Origins thing is one thing because that is so far in the rearview mirror for Fox. Yeah. And, like, the crimes of that movie have been, like, they've been made up for. You know, we got our good Deadpool movie. We've got our good Wolverine movies. It's fine. No one cares about that movie anymore. The Green Lantern thing, WB is still actively trying to make Green Lantern.
Yep.
And Ryan Reynolds is out here shooting himself in the head for reading the script.
I mean, going back in time and correcting the greatest crimes that Ryan Reynolds has committed.
Yes.
Which is X-Men Origins Wolverine and the fucking Green Lantern.
Yes. So, I also just love his reading. He's like, finally, this will be my big break. And he gets shot while smiling. Oh, I love that. So, in terms of the time travel stuff, they do the thing at the end where Deadpool gets shot by Cable and is dying. And I love how protracted that death scene is. It's also very Monty Python and that you think it's going to end. And it just keeps going. And it is both. That's a great fusion of, like, the kind of emotional material in that he has these, like, nice denouements with every character on screen. But it is also funny because each of them is so protracted and it's like he's just killing time.
Yeah.
But then the payoff to the story with him and Cable, of Cable going back and, like, putting the token in and everything. I liked that.
Yes. It's all very, like, cliche. But it works. They pull it off really well. And they sort of, I think they land where they need to land. I'm getting the sense of, like, Cable would probably do this. Although, also, like, if you just took the fucking collar off, he would be fine. There's, like, a little bit of, like, that's one thing that they should have at least made a joke about that, because this is sort of, like, lampshaded a little bit, because it's like, he has fucking healing powers.
Yeah.
Like, if you just take the collar off.
Well, Colossus tries to take it off and he stops him. That's the only reference to it.
Yes, but then after he is no longer physically capable of stopping you, you just, if you're going to save his life against his wishes,
Cable could just rip it off, yes.
Don't waste your fucking, like, one shot at time travel. That's something they should have at least, like, made fun of. Because they made fun of, like, the just, like, oh, this is lazy writing stuff when they did it. That's one that feels like they kind of missed a little bit.
Yes. They could have done that.
Yeah, but generally speaking, I think they nail that stuff that they need to.
I like Cable, like, warming up to the guy enough to do this.
Yeah.
I think that's cute. And then the... So at the end, Yukio and Negasonic Teenage Warhead fix the time thing for him. There's the two obviously just silly scenes of him killing his past selves.
Yeah.
But then there is, he does go back and save Vanessa.
Yeah.
We knew this was going to be a thing. I'm looking at interviews. This is canonical. Like, she's going to be alive in the next movie. It's weird. On one level, it does, like... If they were going to do that, I guess all I would say is that I wish they would have made a more obvious kind of lampshading joke, as you say, about the whole fridging the wife thing.
Yeah.
And made it just a little, like, seated it in a little more throughout so that when they undo it at the end, which is, like, I don't mind that they do that at the end. That's, Deadpool is a silly universe with silly rules. I am fine with that. And if they want to bring her back for the next movie, I love Miranda Baccarin, and that's great, and it does alleviate some of the problems with fridging the wife. I just think, like, you have the opportunity to do the fourth wall, like, jokes about it. That could have been in there a little more.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. And it is something I'm curious to see, you know, if any fucking movie can do it, a Deadpool movie can do it, but of just how do you, like, sort of, like, shave over the, like, weird, like, what does Deadpool know? What are his relationships to these characters? How has that been affected by him? Altering the... Because it's, you know, that's obviously a classic bootstrap paradox. He would have never met any of these people if not for his wife dying, because his wife dying is what set him on this whole adventure. So if his wife never died, he never meets all these people, which means that he never travels back in time to save his wife. It's, you know, that whole thing. I'm curious to see how or if they address that at all in the next movie.
No, I'm fine with it. And the fact that they do bring her back and will let her play in the universe more does make me feel better about it, mostly.
Yeah, me too.
I know Vanessa does, in the comics at some point, have some superpower thing. I feel like that would be the natural next step to take this.
Yeah, because I think there's not a lot of room for that character to do. As you said, like, it's hard once Deadpool and Vanessa have, like, a committed, loving relationship where they're both fine, and they're, like, having kids and they're married. Like, there's not a lot of story to tell there, and you have to find something.
I do think, like... They could do, if they wanted to, an absolutely fantastic Incredibles riff where, like, they are both superpowered and they have a baby and they have to, like, deal with it. That could be very fucking funny if they want to go that direction. I do think, I am curious, I'm not worried, but I am curious what they're going to do in future films of, they have a lot of characters to play with. And you could totally do a Cable Deadpool movie next that would sustain itself on those two alone. Mm-hmm. But you're going to want to make time for the team that we have here.
Yeah.
You know, there's characters we probably want to meet more of. There's going to be new characters to introduce. You're going to have Vanessa back, and I think you want to give her a bigger role next time, because Miranda Baccarin is very good and funny in these movies, and in everything. She's great. So I'm curious to see where they go with this, but this is a surprisingly rich franchise that has, like, a lot of room to grow.
Yeah. And it's, like...
Surprised.
So much more interested in this version of X-Men than Dark Phoenix, right?
Yeah, I mean, we talk about this every time, but, like, the X-Men franchise has a lot of structural deficiencies and then these pockets of brilliance where the Deadpool franchise is firing on all cylinders and works really well. And Deadpool 1 was probably the best X-Men movie up to that point, before Logan pantsed it, you know?
Yeah.
And Logan is just a great movie before you talk about it being a great superhero movie, before you talk about it being a great X-Men movie, right?
Yeah.
So it is on this hill all by itself. But then you have all this other stuff, and it's not clear what their plan is. It's not clear what they think the upside to it is, because that's the other thing, is that with Deadpool, once they started really going outside the box, the R rating, and the different kinds of characters, and the different tone and style... Deadpool 1, 2, and Logan are the highest grossing X-Men movies. Like, they're the most successful, they're the best reviewed, they're the ones people like. Like, back in the day, X2 would kind of break that, but I don't think it holds the same standard as it would back then now. So there's that problem, but they're still going ahead with X-Men Dark Phoenix, which they have moved to a February release.
Right, yeah.
The New Mutants got delayed again. Like, I don't think it's supposed to come out till, like, August 2019 or something. So, like, they must be reshooting, like, half that movie. So, I don't know. And, again, the New Mutants sounds like the kind of thing that could work under this model.
Yeah, doing the pseudo-horror thing. It's August 2nd, 2019.
This was supposed to have already come out, guys. Yes. Like, that got fucking delayed.
That movie is basically done, right? That's got to be the...
It was. I mean, it was going to come out April this year. It was done. They're reshooting it. I mean, that's the thing. They've said they're doing a lot to it. So I don't know if that's the good reshoots or the Justice League reshoots. We'll find out. But yeah, like, to me, this would be the moment to reboot X-Men. Like, this would be the moment. Deadpool doesn't care if you reboot it. He just jokes about it in the next movie,
like,
and you're good.
Yeah, that's just fodder. Like, you just can do that.
Yeah, Logan is... Wolverine's dead. Hugh Jackman's gone. This would be the moment. Just start again. Do it fresh. Get someone who actually cares about X-Men to make the movies and could make a team X-Men movie, you know. But they're doing X-Men Dark Phoenix. And it's like... Each of those movies, like First Class, did okay. Days of Future Past was pretty big, and then Apocalypse did okay again.
Yeah.
I don't really see what they think the upside is in all this. Like, they're just... the whole... I guess what I'm trying to say is the superhero genre has moved on. Deadpool has adapted to it very well, because it's one of the things that pushed it forward in a different direction. And they're still trying to make the same X-Men movies over here. It's very strange.
Yeah, and it's the thing that we've seen with, like, Thor Ragnarok and Black Panther.
Yeah.
And in many ways, I think, stuff from Infinity War over on the Marvel side, that it's like, you have to go and swing big and make interesting movies with, like, distinct voices. And Wonder Woman is another one of those. It's like, that's where the superhero movies are. Like, you have to do that. You can't make... Like, you can't make fucking X-Men Apocalypse. You can't make the, like, Iron Man 2s of the world. You know, you can't be this sort of, like, by-the-numbers, dull superhero flick. We have 100 of those. It has to be something that, like, really goes for it.
Yeah.
And if nothing else, Deadpool 2 fucking goes for it.
Fucking goes for it. We have had 3 superhero movies this year. Black Panther, Infinity War, and Deadpool 2. I loved all of them so far. They've all been really fucking good.
So I think it's about time for superhero fatigue to set in then. I think that's what that means, that if we liked all of these movies and people saw them.
It's
the two of, like, the most successful movies ever in Black Panther and Infinity War.
I'll bitch about this for a second. There is a sector of criticism that so wants superhero fatigue to be a thing. And
they've wanted it to be a thing since, like, 2010.
Yes. And I get if you don't like superhero movies. That's fine. I will also say, the superhero genre is probably better on the whole than it has ever been. I think in terms of just the amount of creative richness going on, the number of different... Like, if there is not a superhero movie out there in the last couple of years that appeals to you, I'd kind of be surprised. There's got to be something for everyone. You know, I have some, you know, professorial, you know, friends, academics who, you know, if nothing else, Black Panther's there.
Yeah.
And that's a teachable, interesting, academic movie as well as being fun. But there are so many different things. You've got, you know, your bombs every once in a while, like everything DC's doing other than Wonder Woman. But overall, like, there's a lot of, like, Deadpool 2, Infinity War, and Black Panther, also 3 very different movies.
Yeah.
By 3 different sets of filmmakers. I've liked them all. Thor Ragnarok last year was great. Logan is just a grenade thrown into the genre. I really do think it's a special moment. And, you know, yeah, there will be fatigue one day. Obviously, it's going to move on. I also think the superhero, quote-unquote, genre is still a genre. I think you can define it that way. But I think it's moving past some generic definitions in terms of how it works and how many different modes it's entering into.
It's like, because I see people trying to do, like, a historical thing of comparing it to the Western or something. It's like, it's not hard... That's not a, like, also, one-to-one. Like, the Western, like, genre, and, like, most of those kinds of genres are really restricted and are contained to specific historical tropes and moments. And, like, superhero movies, kind of like science fiction, can be anything. Like, you know, like, science fiction, depending on how you, like, don't want to fucking massive semantic debate about it. But generally speaking, a, like, normal audience member would understand science fiction to be able to be both Star Wars and Star Trek. You know? It can be fucking Annihilation, and it can be Arrival, and it can be, like, all this shit. Like it's a huge, broad umbrella that so much can fall under, that's, like, comedy and drama and tragedy and, like, intelligent and silly and all that. And superheroes are the exact same way.
I also think there's something historically uninformed about talking about genre fatigue. We make, like, 5 superhero movies a year.
Yeah.
Like, Westerns? Hundreds. Like, literally, dozens a year. Just every weekend, there would be, like, 5 new Westerns in theaters. Or musicals at their height. 5 musicals a week or something, you know? Or the worst would be, like, slasher movies. I'm listening to this, I've mentioned this podcast before, it's called 80s All Over, hosted by the film critic Drew McQueenie, where they go month by month through the 80s, and it's interesting because it is, I think genuinely, like, they're not just saying, like, oh, look at all this nostalgia we love. It's, like, really trying to talk about the trends of the decade and what kind of movie, and I find it very interesting. As someone who, I don't have a lot of interest in the 80s, I don't like most 80s movies I've seen, other than some of the really good ones, but I find it a very interesting podcast historically, and one of the things I realized is, like, some months there would literally be like 8 slasher movies in 1 month, and they'd all be the same thing.
I mean, how do you think all those franchises have like 100 sequels, even the ones you've never even heard of?
And so Puppet Master and some shit. If you're a critic today who's like, or I want to review real movies, I don't want to have to go to a superhero movie every 3 months, be lucky you're not in the 80s and seeing 7 slasher movies in a week. Like, and I do understand the argument that none of those slasher movies generally were on the scale of superhero movies that, you know, a lot of superhero movies today are interconnected and they're sequels and you have to see a lot of them if you kind of want to get everything. But even then, if you really just wanted to ignore superhero movies, you have 5 movies to ignore a year. You do not have 75.
Yeah.
I think Hollywood is just in such a materially different place. That also means that superhero movies suck up maybe a similar amount of oxygen in the room. But I don't know. I think it's just a very different discussion. And to me, the fatigue thing, you can look at the money, and that's one thing. Obviously, there is no fatigue if you look at the money. That's a stupid argument that you cannot make. Critically, though, I also think, like, more interestingly to me, I have found, we've been covering these movies on these fucking podcasts for like 8 years.
For this whole podcast.
For this whole podcast. I am more excited to talk about these, and we talk about them more regularly now because they're better.
Yeah. And you know? We have more interesting discussions. There's more to talk about.
Yeah. So, Deadpool 2... You were surprisingly good.
Yes.
I like you. Josh Brolin, be in more movies. Yes. You're already in a lot of movies, but you could be in even more.
If you want to show up for other comic book movies, like, you're welcome, because you fucking nailed it.
Who are some other characters Josh Brolin could play?
Any of them? I'm trying to think of, like, I mean, honestly, if they have to recast Wolverine, dude, like, straight up, Josh Brolin would be a pretty good fucking Wolverine, right?
They at least need to make that joke in the next X-Men movie, or the next Deadpool movie. Put him in the yellow spandex.
Yes.
Have him pretend to be Wolverine for 2 minutes. Get the joke. Get out.
Yes.
All right.
Okay.
Well, anyway, that's it for this week. Next week, we have yet another movie to talk about, which is Solo, A Star Wars Story.
Yes.
I have no idea whether or not I should be excited for this one.
Yeah, I felt like the reception after the premiere was very like,
Yeah, so we'll see. I'm open to really liking it.
I look forward to Donald Glover in that movie.
I look forward to just figuring out what the fuck that movie is.
I think it's going to be a very pandering Star Wars movie, is what I'm preparing myself for.
All right.
Anyways, to bring this podcast to a conclusion, Jonathan, when you were talking about the filmography of Ryan Reynolds and I was on Wikipedia, realized they're really fucking making that Detective Pikachu movie, that he's going to be the voice of Detective Pikachu?
Yeah.
And Ken Watanabe is going to be in that movie.
Yeah.
And Bill Nighy is going to be in that movie. In live action. Why?
I can't wait for Deadpool 3 when he shoots Pikachu in the head.
Why?